call the State Board meeting to order. Ms. Cordial, would you please call the roll?
Board Member Durham.
Here.
Board Member Flores.
Here.
Board Member Goff.
Here.
Board Member Masneck.
Here.
Board Member McClellan.
Here.
Board Member Rankin.
Here.
And Board Member Schroeder.
Here. Please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. Rebecca, would you please leave us?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Our first item is the approval of the agenda. Is there a motion, please? To approve. Thank you. Second?
Second.
Any opposition? Thank you. So the agenda has been moved by Board Member Durham, seconded by Board Member McClellan. Final vote is unanimous. You were supposed to say that.
I thought you had the unanimous.
I don't have any idea.
Okay. All right. I'll do it.
We're trying to remember everything that we learned about who does what at what time. The only thing nobody's going to argue with is if I call a break. Everything else we is just going to totally be subject to discussion. All right, moving on to the consent agenda. Do I have a motion to place items on the consent agenda? Board Member Rankin?
I move, no. Yes.
Yes.
I move to place the following matters on the consent agenda. 15.01. Approve the Charter School Institute's request for waivers on behalf of Monarch Classical School of the Arts as set forth in the published agenda. 15.02, approve Douglas County RE1 School District's request for waivers on behalf of Parker Performing Arts School as set forth in the published agenda. 15.03, approve Douglas County RE1 School District's request for waivers on behalf of Ascent Classical Academy as set forth in the published agenda. 16.01, regarding disciplinary proceedings concerning a license and an application. Charge number 201 to EC94, direct department staff and the State Attorney General's office to prepare the documents necessary to request a formal hearing for the revocation of the license holder's professional principal license pursuant to section 24-4-104 CRS, and direct department staff to issue a notice of denial and appeal rights to the applicant pursuant to section 24-4-104 Colorado Revised Statutes. 16.02, regarding disciplinary proceedings concerning an application, charge number 201-5-EC-668, direct department staff to issue a notice of denial and appeal rights to the applicant pursuant to section 24-4-104 Colorado Revised Statutes. 16.03, approve the 6 initial emergency authorization requests as set forth in the published agenda. 16.04, approve the 2 renewal emergency authorization requests as set forth in the published agenda. This is the end of the consent agenda.
Thank you. That's a proper motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Any changes?
Madam Chair, I request the removal of item 16.02 from the consent agenda. Okay. Have it come up in normal order.
Yes. Can we put that on the end of the agenda tomorrow or today, based on staffing?
We can do today.
Today?
Today would actually be better because it would fall right before the notice of rulemaking for the licensure rules.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. And then we'll have the appropriate staff here.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? So item 16.02 has been removed from the consent agenda by Board Member Durham. Is there a second to that change?
I second that.
Dr. Flores. All in favor?
Madam Chair, just for the record, the consent agenda by definition requires unanimous consent, so I don't think you need a second.
For the change? This was only a second for the change.
For the change.
Yeah, I don't think you need a second.
For the change?
Okay.
A consent agenda by definition requires unanimous consent.
Right.
So you don't need a second.
Okay.
The objection of any members is not to have removed from the agenda.
Okay. all in favor of the consent agenda as amended, as changed?
Aye.
Aye.
Final vote is unanimous. We'll get this down in a couple of years. The next item on the agenda is a report from Director of Board Relations, Ms. Cordial. What do you have for us today?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board, Commissioner Anthes. As always, please speak clearly into your microphones, and if you turn them off when you're not speaking, just remember to please turn them back on. Those of you needing to connect to CDE's guest wireless, locate CDE hotspot, and the password is still silver, capital S. In your board packets, you have your quick glance expense report and events calendar. A couple of events that are coming up that I'd like to remind you of include the West Slope Superintendent Conference, September 19th and 20th, and the NASB Annual Convention, November 1st through 4th. Also in your board packets and or available on board docs are the following materials for today. Item 7.01, a memo regarding the standards and assessments for English learners and accompanying PowerPoint. Item 8.01, memo regarding the Colorado READ Act rules, accompanying PowerPoint. House Bill 171160, a red line copy of the rules to statute crosswalk, and response to written comments that we've received up to this point. For item 12.01, you have a memo regarding the 2017 online and blended educator recognition. For item 13.01, you have a memo regarding the rules for the administration of the Protection from Persons Restraint Act, a red line and clean copy of those rules, a red and clean version of the rules with annotations, the rules to statute crosswalk, state level compliant procedures, state complaint form, the flow chart of the complaint procedures, and a response to written comments document with comments that we've received up to this point. For items 14.01 and 14.02, you have memos regarding the 2017 culturally and linguistically diverse education recognitions, the distinguished administrators, and the student art winners. For items 15.01 through 15.04, you have memos supporting the materials pertaining to charter school waiver requests. For item 16.03, you have a memo regarding the six initial emergency authorization requests. Item 16.04, a memo regarding the two renewal emergency authorization requests. Item 16.05, a memo regarding the notice of rulemaking for the Educator Licensing Act rules, a red line and clean copy of the amended section of those rules, and the rules to statute crosswalk. For item 17.01, you have a memo regarding the ESSA state plan and accompanying PowerPoint. The materials you have for Thursday are the following. Item 3.01, a memo regarding the 2018 school and district performance framework targets, accompanying PowerPoint, and proposed scoring guide. For item 4.01, you have the draft State Board of Education operating procedures. For item 5.01, you have a memo regarding the rules for the administration of the School Health Professional Grant Program, as well as a red line and clean copy of those rules. For item 6.01, you have a memo regarding the graduation guidelines and accompanying PowerPoint. And for item 8.01, you have a memo regarding the Safe Communities, Safe Schools research request, accompanying PowerPoint, and background information on Safe Communities, Safe Schools project. And that concludes the materials I have for you for the October meeting. In addition to my report, I'd just like to share with you all and the public that in the near future, we will be implementing video streaming of our regular state board meetings. This was after our discussion about video streaming at our board retreat. We got the thumbs up to go forward, so we will be working on that in the next few months, and then we will post signs to notify the public that the meeting is being streamed and recorded. And additionally, we will have the link to the video streaming on our website, similar to how we have the audio recording right now. For the public to access while the meeting is running. We anticipate to start this, giving ourselves a little bit of wiggle room at the end of this year, beginning of next year, and then we will let you know in advance when we are going to start video streaming. So, do you have any questions about this?
I have a question, which is, will this equipment be changed out as a result?
I don't believe so.
So I've been told by a colleague who has been listening to past meetings that some of us are doing a really good job of coming through on the microphones.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us, myself included, are doing a really poor job. And I'm wondering what it is that I think some of us maybe have stronger voices so that it picks up better, but we probably ought to be thinking about it, to what extent we need to make some improvements.
Okay.
And I don't know, I would encourage you to go back and listen. Mm-hmm. And I know sometimes we forget to turn it on, but other times I have a feeling we're just back far enough that we're not picking up. And I don't know how to solve that, but
okay.
I know you know how, so.
We'll look into that.
Okay. Thank you. Any other?
Madam Chair.
Just a second. Ms. Goff?
Ms. Cordial, you said the beginning of this year, the next year, calendar year or school
year? Calendar year, so December, January is what I'm thinking, but
thanks.
Board Member Durham?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to apologize to the board and to the staff and audience for not silencing my cell phone again, second meeting in a row, so I'm working on it. I'll try and do better. Thank you.
Shall we forgive them, folks?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Durham. So the next item, information item on standards and assessments for English language learners. Commissioner?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, everyone. This is a slot. This is a presentation that you all have been requesting over the past several months on sort of a study session on English language learners. And we're calling it sort of a mini series, because either we would have made you have another meeting where we would do an all-day study session about it, or we decided to break up the presentation into multiple parts. So this is actually part two of the mini series, and if you like it and you give us good ratings, we'll bring you a part three. But part one was last month when you got a state of the state in terms of a data presentation on English language learners. And now the team is going to give you some more information about what this looks like from a student perspective. So we have recognized that over the months, you all have been asking really good questions about standards, assessments, how we support English language learners, teacher requirements. And so we decided to try to bring that all together so that you could understand the bigger picture. I will apologize. Just I know that you got this PowerPoint incredibly late, and I'm sorry. That's not our normal practice, and we always strive to not do that. This was it was actually challenging for us as well, because we were working across units, and we will always work really hard not to do that, but since this is an information item and there will be a future time to present about this, we hope that that's okay, but I do apologize.
Excuse me, is the PowerPoint not on Board Docs yet?
It is on Board Docs,
and there's one in front of you, I think.
Oh, I see it now. Mine don't. Board Docs looks different.
It does. Yes, it had a facelift.
I thought I had a problem with my computer, so I'm glad to hear that it's not me.
It's not you.
Yes. So, and then the only other thing is this is a 90-minute presentation. There's a lot of information. I would recommend, but I won't. I'll leave it to the chair to decide. I would recommend you write your questions down, because most likely they will be answered in the rest of the presentation. But if there's something that you're just dying that is really unclear, or we used an acronym or something that you need to get clarified right then please let us know. And just to also let you know, I'm probably stealing all of Melissa's thunder. We will have a part three, even if you don't give us good ratings. and that will be on the accountability section of it and the teacher preparation section of this. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Kolsman, who will introduce the team and the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Anthus. I will ask my colleagues to introduce themselves, and we'll have a colleague to my right first.
Dr. Floyd Cobb, Executive Director of Teaching and Learning.
You guys can speak up real loud.
Heather Villalobos, English Language Learner Assessment Specialist within the Assessment Unit.
Pat Chapman, Executive Director of the Federal Programs Unit.
So as you can see, we have colleagues from across the department today presenting, and we'll recognize that the content experts for a lot of this work provided a lot of the content that you see here, but we are not necessarily the content depth experts on everything, and we think that that actually gives you an opportunity to kind of shift your role during this presentation different than what you typically need to do. Typically, we bring information items before you because you need to make a decision. And we typically go very, very deep on one particular piece of an issue. What you have today is actually the luxury of not having to make a decision based on what you hear today, but instead take a look at across multiple initiatives in the department that touch on English learners, get a sense of the big picture about how all of these work together. And so before moving forward, I do want to just acknowledge all of the staff in our culturally and linguistically diverse education office who provided so much support here, also our assessment office through Heather Villalobos, and also our Office of Standards and Instructional Support and Federal Programs. A lot of folks kind of came together to bring this forward to you today. So as Dr. Anthus noted at our last meeting, you got a sense of the demographics of English learners in the state, and you could get a good picture that there's not one single experience of English learners. We have dozens of languages in the state. We have students who enter at different points in their educational career, and so to try to say what is the experience of an English learner, it's not possible to do so. But what we'll endeavor to do today is to put in context what our topics are, standards and assessments, through the experience of three sample students to get a sense of how these work through the eyes of a student. But what we're first going to do is start out with an overview of the laws that support English learners. We are then going to look at the distinction between social and academic English. We'll spend a little bit of time looking at the academic versus English language proficiency standards. We're going to look at issues around how to identify English learners. We'll look at assessments as they relate to English learners. We'll look at instruction as it relates to English learners, and that's where we're going to pull all of these things together through the experience of a student. So at first it's going to feel like we're talking about some isolated pieces, but our goal is to weave them together through the experience of three kind of sample students with different kind of demographic backgrounds. Now as you are participating in this today, a couple of things to keep in mind. Keep in the back of your mind what you learned at the September meeting about the different demographics of our English learners. And then you might want to be considering looking forward to what we're going to be doing in November, which is thinking about accountability and how are schools and districts held accountable for meeting the needs of English learners. And another thing to keep in the back of your mind is what are the educator preparation needs in order for a teacher to be able to be instructing these students. We're not addressing that today, but that's just something to help kind of as a preview for you. So again, while there's no singular experience for English learners, we thought it would be useful to, at the second part of our presentation is to talk about how all of these things tie together through three sample students. So I'm going to introduce you to them today, right now. Our first sample student, student A, is a six-year-old student who is in first grade. The student's home language is in Spanish, and this student is not literate in their home language. And the student is classified as an NEP, non-English proficient. And we're going to look at later how the district develops and develops a plan to meet the needs of that student. Student B is going to be kind of a different experience. This is an 11-year-old entering a Colorado school for the first time. And this is a student in sixth grade whose home language is Vietnamese. And this student has limited literacy in their home language and has limited English proficiency. And then the final student that we'll look at is a student whose home language is Somali and is entering a U.S. school for the first time as a 15-year-old in high school. And this student is not literate in their home language and has had interrupted schooling. And this student is also a non-English proficient student. So we've chosen these particular scenarios to kind of illustrate some particular things. For the student A, what we've done is we've deliberately picked a first grader because this student would be assessed through using a READ Act assessment for their reading and the WIDA assessment or access assessment for their English language development. So give you a sense of kind of how those work together. And then we also chose, especially for the 16-year-old or 15-year-old student, highlighting some particular needs of students who come through these types of experiences. So from here, I'm going to hand off to my colleague, Pat Chapman, to talk a bit about the progression of English learners going from identification to full English proficiency.
First, I'm going to knock out the acronym slide because I think we've already started using them. It's a little bit difficult because this stuff is also interconnected to know how to order the slides. But you will see in the slides a number of acronyms, EL for English learner, NEP for non-English proficient, LEP for limited English proficient, FEP for fluent English proficient, and ELD for English language development, usually within the context of English language development programs. One of the things that I think the intent of this presentation is to give you guys a good sense of the continuum of from identification to proficiency, English language proficiency, and academic proficiency, and exiting of English language development programs. So this is we're thinking this is a helpful slide to help you get that comprehensive view. You see along the top at 5 to 8 years to move from identification to English language proficiency and academic proficiency, with the first part of that being the identification process, which is a pretty fundamental part of it, where incoming students are assessed. Those students with a home language other than English are assessed to identify whether or not that student is in need of academic and linguistic supports. If they are identified as EL, they will get support for English language development and access to grade level contents to academic standards for a couple of years. At that point that they are become fluent English proficient, they will need minimal support for English language development and access to grade level academic standards. And they go enter the monitoring period where they're monitored for up to 2 years, where that those supports are begin to be taken away. And then after they are formally exited from English language development programs. And basically that really means up to 2 years they can be counted as ELs for the purposes of accountability and so forth, and we'll talk more about that. So that sort of gives you that sense of from identification to fluency what happens for students, and we'll go dive much deeper into that during the presentation. A little bit about the laws supporting English learners, both state and federal law. Won't go into detail about each of the individual laws, but really I think it's safe to say that they all go back to the Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. There's subsequent case law and Supreme Court rulings and additional federal law and indeed state law that get at the what civil rights mean within the context of education. So things related to language barriers, immigration status, and those. There are a number of rulings throughout the last several decades that begin to define what it means, what civil rights are within the context of education. So with that, and if you do have any specific questions about case law during the presentation, we can go deeper, but just kind of wanted to give you that grounding. And I will turn it back over to Melissa.
Thank you, Pat. So we thought it would be important that as we are thinking about English language acquisition, to distinguish between social English and academic English. This is a really important distinction to make because it impacts really what students have access to in the classroom. So social language is just the everyday language that students use either in oral or written form with their friends or their teachers. And the student's ability to use language, English language, in a social setting is not necessarily a predictor of their academic language capacity, and it's not necessarily related. Academic language is the language needed to be successful in school. It's directly related to the language needed to understand standards, be able to read a textbook, write an essay, complete assignments, and understand the specific language of disciplines. And academic language is used in all grade levels, whether or not it's a kindergarten student or a senior, and the frequency and complexity of that academic language increases at higher grade levels. I'm going to give you an example of a student that I had, like my first English learner that entered my classroom as a math teacher. His name, I'm going to mask his name, but I'll call him Randy. So Randy came into my seventh grade math class, and he just came right in, and he was, you know, introduced himself, and he could speak to me and talk very easily about, oh, I'm going to go sit over there. Oh, here, you know, go pick up the pencil, or here's your book. I'm going to sign this out to you. And he could speak to me, and how are you doing? Oh, I'm doing well. How are you adjusting? Great. I feel great about, you know, do you have someone to eat lunch with? I assumed that because he could do that, that he would seamlessly integrate right into my math classroom, and I would have to really not worry so much about him. But what happened is, as soon as I handed out a sheet with an assignment on it, he kept coming up to me over and over again. Well, what about this? What do you mean a table? Like, what does the table have to do with this? And I was thinking, in a math class, I wanted them to write a table that would show the x coordinates on one column and the y coordinates on the other. He had no idea what a table was. The word coordinate is not part of social language. That's part of academic language. So I had to be thinking about things such as general things like compare and contrast two functions. Compare, we were saying, how are they alike? Contrast, how are they different? So very much an academic piece. But that one is an example that doesn't relate only to math. That translates across content areas. So when we're thinking about English learners, we really have to be thinking about how are we supporting them with the academic language that they won't encounter in their day-to-day life, and distinguish between how a term would be used, such as law, we just said that here. In a social studies class, a law means something because the laws are passed by particular elected bodies, whereas a law in mathematics is not passed by anybody. It's something that exists in the natural world. So being aware of that is really important, and because of that, it is there are many factors that would lead to whether or not a student can acquire that full English proficiency across academic and social language in that 5 to 8 year span. So for instance, if a student comes with some academic language in their native language, and all they're doing is translating their native language to English and finding the English word for that, that is simpler than having to build the academic language and English at the same time. So when we think about that 5 to 8 year span, we want to think about the age of the child. We want to think about their academic and schooling background, whether or not they've had interrupted schooling or not. We want to be thinking about whether they're literate in their home language. And this is why what we've done is, with our three student examples, is we're giving you three different student experiences to help you understand why or why not they might be struggling with academic language. So because we have our English learners are coming in and need to have access to grade level content, our academic standards spell out the academic expectations for students in the 10 content areas that are listed on the left. And each of those content areas has their own academic language. And so thinking about what is the specific language a student needs to understand in order to access the science curriculum in terms of understanding what photosynthesis is, for instance, versus how that differs from, let's say, oh, another great subject like maybe math. You guys are supposed to laugh there because that's the best subject there is. Yes. So ratio. So ratio would be a specific term there. So because of that, the English language proficiency standards provides support for students to access that language of those grade levels. So the English language proficiency standards have standards related to the language of math, the language of language arts, the language of science, the language of social studies. It's not teaching the content. It's helping them teach the language of the content. And so the English language proficiency standards really are those standards that help students access the academic content. So just as a reminder, it's important to keep in mind how state standards work in relation to instruction. Because whereas the academic standards need to be met by all students, and the English language proficiency standards help give access to those, how districts go about implementing those and using those varies across the state. In a local control state, we know that standards are set at the state, but curriculum instruction as it pertains to student is really set at the local level or district level, which is why there's a number of different types of programs across the state. So to say that there's one experience for students, again, really is kind of made more complex by kind of our the way our system works. However, that also makes it easier for locals to be able to meet the needs of their particular students. So I'm going to hand off now to Heather Villalobos to talk more about the identification process for students as well as assessments.
Thank you. So when we are looking at how we would identify English learners, every student who enrolls to a school is given a home language survey, a home language questionnaire. You'll hear us refer to it as HLS throughout the rest of the presentation. And it is a document that is required by law, and it is given to all new-to-district students. And some districts have the questions within the HLS incorporated into the mainstream registration packet. Some districts have it as a separate form, but they all give it to every student. It is a tool to be used with all students to identify possible language influences other than English. So you'll hear us refer to students who may have a primary or home language other than English, so that to help us identify students who maybe speak another language, who are influenced by hearing another language and may not be hearing English as often as a student from an English-only home. There are three required questions included in the district developed form. The questions all address the same concept, but districts get to phrase them in a way that is best for them. And it must be filled out when a student enrolls, so it's not optional. Should a family skip it, the registrar will often find them to make sure it does get filled out. What the home language survey is not. It is not optional. It is not just for students who are believed to be ELs, so there's no profiling of students who look like they may be English learners. It is administered to everybody because English learners come in all ages and colors and ethnicities. It is not an assessment. It is just a survey or a questionnaire for the parents to fill out. And it is not a CDE form. Districts do get to fill it out to best meet the needs of their population. So according to federal law, the three questions that must be asked, and it's any variance of these three questions, as I mentioned earlier, they may phrase them in a way that they feel is friendliest for their community. The first question must address what is or was the student's first language, or what is the native language of the student. The second question needs to collect information related to, does the student speak a language other than English? And it's to be sure to not include languages learned in school, but influenced from the home. And if yes, we ask them to list the language. And what languages are spoken most often by the student? And then the third question needs to collect information related to what languages are spoken in the home. So now that we have possibly identified an English learner, we'll look at the continued assessments on identifying and assessments they participate in as English learners. So assessments used in Colorado Public Schools, the two assessments that are only for English learners are the WAPT. Those letters of WAPT stand for WIDA Access Placement Test, so it is part of the WIDA test. It is used, it identifies students who qualify for English language development programming. It's administered once to all new students who have a primary or home language other than English, And so if the home language survey has given indication that the student may need to have the WAPT, they'd administer it, districts will then provide the WAPT. Access 2.0, the Access 2.0 for ELLs measures English language proficiency. Access is administered annually to all students identified as English learners, and it is administered until their school district redesignates them as fully English proficient. Assessments used for all students, including English learners, the READ, Reading to Ensure Academic Development Act assessment. It identifies significant reading deficiencies. It is required twice a year. CMAS, and READ is for students in grades K through 3. CMAS, the Colorado Measures of Academic Success, measures mastery of standards in English language arts, math, science, and social studies, administered at the end of the school year, and it is for students in grades 3 through 8. PSAT and SAT measure math and evidence-based reading and writing. SAT includes an opportunity for students to take an additional optional essay administered at the end of the school year. The PSAT is in grade 9 and 10, and the SAT is in grade 11. Specific information on the WAPT. Again, the WAPT is the common screener used with a body of evidence to identify English learners. It is given to students who have a primary or home language other than English indicated on their home language survey. So while the home language survey is given to every student who's newly enrolled in the district, the WAPT is only administered if the family has then indicated that there is a language other than English. There is no official test window for the WAPT because it must be administered once upon district enrollment. So if district enrollment is in October, they would administer in October. If district enrollment is in March, they would administer in March. And again, the WAPT screens for language proficiency to help schools and districts identify English learners. Access 2.0 is the annual English language proficiency assessment. It addresses social and academic language and the language of instruction. Access is administered annually. It is a 5-week testing window. It goes January, February. It opens on the second Monday of January. All students who are identified as NEP and LEP are required to participate in Access. If a student has a parent who has choiced them out of EL services, but the student would still participate in the Access for ELLs assessment because they are identified as an NEP or LEP. The exception to students who would take Access 2.0 are students with the most significant cognitive disabilities who take alternate Access for ELLs. So it is the English language proficiency version of our alternate assessments, and Access measures progress toward English proficiency. After we just spoke about Access, here's a moment to look at the instructional information that a teacher would receive on a student's individual student report. As you can see, the teacher is given information on how the student's language skills are. It is not giving them content-specific information, but particularly if we wanted to look at reading, this student is a proficiency level 1. And you can see that the resources that are ideas that it's giving to teachers to guide instruction are understand written text that include visuals and may contain a few words or phrases in English. For example, interpret information from graphs, charts, and other visual information. Comprehend short text with illustrations and simple and familiar language. Identify steps and processes presented in graphs or short text with illustrations. And identify words and phrases that express opinions and claims. And I highlighted reading specifically because we'll look at READ Act information in a moment. So looking at READ Act, and again, I am within the assessment unit, and READ Act is supported by the Office of Literacy, but I will speak to it within this assessment section. The READ Act requires teachers to assess the literacy development of K through 3 students in the areas of phonemic awareness, phonics, vocabulary development, reading fluency, including oral skills, and reading comprehension using a state board-approved interim reading assessment. Possible exception to the READ Act are students in their first year in the U.S. who are identified as NEP may be exempted based on a body of evidence. So here is a test and result of a subtest within a state approved REDACT assessment. And you can see here that they're really working on the phonemic awareness of a student. So the teacher would say the word hall, and then the student would say which phonemic sounds they heard. So they'd say, tell me what sounds you hear when I say the word hall. And we'd have the student go, oh. So here you can see in the word count, the student missed some sounds. And in the word birds, the student missed a sound, added a Z at the end, ER, 3 out of 4 there. But you'll note that the information provided to the teacher here is much more reading and phonemic focused. It's not a general language proficiency development, but skills on consistently segmented all phonemes in words, but did not segment enough phonemes to meet the benchmark. Reinforcement activities, and then it gives instructional ideas. Reinforcement activities that focus on segmenting and blending phonemes to build automaticity may be beneficial. So it gives that specific reading information, and that is the difference between information provided by Access and a REDACT assessment. And again, this is just information from one subtest within a REDACT assessment. So the REDACT test would provide much more reading-specific information. Continuing with the content assessments, the CMAS assessment is the end-of-year standards-based content assessment, assessing English language arts, math, science, and social studies. All students, including English learners in the corresponding grades, are required to participate in the CMAS administration annually. There are two exemptions to students who participate in CMAS, and that could be students first year in U.S. identified as NEP are exempt only from the English language arts assessment. And students with the most significant cognitive disabilities who take COALT. And CMAS measures mastery of the grade level Colorado academic standards, skills, and concepts. Our final content assessment is the PSAT-SAT. It's the end of year suite of assessments in high school. They assess evidence-based reading and writing and math. All students, including English learners and the corresponding grades, are required to participate in the annual administration of the SAT suite of assessments. There are also exceptions to the SAT suite of assessments, and that students first year in US identified as NEP are exempt from taking the evidence-based reading and writing assessment. And again, students with the most significant cognitive disabilities who take COALT. PSAT and SAT measure achievement and growth in relation to essential college and career readiness success outcomes. And with that, I will pass the presentation to Dr. Cobb.
Good morning. My aim to you is to be able to discuss a little bit about what's required in terms of instructing English learners. The goal really is to provide a little bit of context to all the information that was provided before in terms of the experiences of a couple of students. And so prior to doing that, what I'd like to do is to be able to explain a little bit more about the English language development models that do exist in the state of Colorado. As Dr. Colesman mentioned, in looking at the difference between standards, curriculum, and instruction, specifically focusing on the instructional side, that is a decision that gets made at the local level. And so in providing a little bit of context to a couple of the models that you see on the screen, the first I want to bring up is the newcomer program. The newcomer program is one that is really intensive and specific to helping students accelerate their language acquisition in English, but really more importantly, to make sure that the students have an opportunity to get acculturated to the United States of America. That is a very intensive type of a program for students. The next would be content classes with integrated support, really focusing on English language support in general, and looking at a content classes with integrated support. Two of those models would be a push-in English language development program, and in those programs, the instruction really is kind of focused in a simultaneous vein in terms of both English language development as well as content. And so really making sure that the English language development component of it is not separated and distinct. A sheltered class would be a class that would be specific for English learners, specifically related to content, and given in a slightly different vein. In terms of an English language development program or traditional ESL pullout program and looking at those programs specifically are designed to teach English learners explicitly about English language. And so in that type of a model, the English language learners are removed from the content class specifically. On co-teaching is actually a version of a content class with integrated English language support. However, where co-teaching is a little bit different than the aforementioned models is that in the co-teaching model, the English language development teacher along with the content teacher share in the actual instruction of the content itself. The next model that I'll explain to you is a dual language or a two-way immersion model. That is a form of a bilingual model. And in looking at the dual language model, the focus with that is to actually have a bilingual program which really promotes students' ability to maintain language proficiency in two languages, receiving instruction in English as well as another language in the classroom. And so in looking at that model is a little bit different than the traditional or transitional bilingual education program in the sense that it would have native English speakers along with speakers of another language who are part of that class. And the opportunity here is will be given for students to learn both a foreign language or a different language with other students who are native to that language. And then finally, a transitional and traditional bilingual early education or bilingual program is one that maintains and develops skills in the primary language while introducing and maintaining developing skills in English. And really the primary purpose of the traditional bilingual program is to facilitate English learners' transition out of the program into an all-English program. And so what I'll do again is just revisit very quickly our three students, our students A, B, and C. And what my goal is really to be able to provide you with a little bit of more context in terms of how all of the information that was provided previously will apply. So just as a refresher, our student A is a six-year-old student who would be in first grade. His or her home language would be in Spanish. This student would not be literate in his or her home language and would be non-English proficient. Student B is a student who is 11 years old, would be in sixth grade. His or her home language would be Vietnamese, and has a limited literacy in the home language, and as a result, we have made this student limited English proficient. And then finally, student C is a 15-year-old student who would be in high school, whose home language is Somali. And this is the student that Dr. Kozman referenced was not literate in the home language due to interrupted schooling and would be non-English proficient. And so in all of these, the district would develop a plan. And so in providing a little context, this is just a brief refresher. If a student were in first grade and were new to the U.S., as Heather revealed, the student would take a home, or the parents would be given a home language survey, which would reveal that the student would speak a language other than English. And the student would then sit for the WAPT and show that the student is non-English proficient. And in this particular example, the district would offer a co-teaching program. And so for students who are non-English proficient, what we typically find as representative of their abilities would be that a non-English proficient student would be able to use pictorial and graphic representations of the language in the content areas. And the student would be able to respond to words and phrases or chunks of language when presented with one-step commands, directions, choice, or yes-no questions or statements with interactive support. The student would also be able to use oral language with a few errors that sometimes impede meeting when presented in basic oral commands and provide directions or simple statements with some interactive support. So in looking at this as it applies back to the content standards, and the English language proficiency standards. On the Colorado academic standards, as an example, and Heather gave an example of this previously, that a student would need to know and be able to apply grade level phonics and word analysis skills in decoding words and accurately decode unknown words that follow a predictable letters and sound pattern relationship. And so in the example that she gave, I'll give kind of a separate example. Making sure that if a student were trying to explain or spell or sound out the word bug, they all have very hard and specific sounds, the b, the and the g sound. And so as someone who is learning English as a language, understanding how those letters actually correspond to those sounds. And so while there may be an understanding of how that might work in the native language, making that transition to English, is a skill that has to be developed. On the language support side, how this blends together, the student would use pointing gestures to demonstrate awareness to those unique sounds and support access to text through using similar language and features. And so these are some simple examples, family and familia, insect and insectos, and problem and problema. And so in looking at the broad scope of this student's assessment experience, over the course of this student's entirety in the public educational system, what you'll see overall is the slide above is really showing how the student would experience schooling in context with the assessment. So in looking at first grade, as you can see, the student would take the WAPT and take the access for the language development components. And the student is eligible to take the READ assessment. However, as you may know, that students in their first year in the U.S. may be exempt from that exam. And so in moving forward to the subsequent years, you can see that the student would continue to take the READ exam to continue to develop reading proficiency in concert with the access exams. And as the student continues to progress, moving more forward to the CMAS exams in grades 3 through 8, while progressing to the PSAT in grades 9 and 10, as well as taking both the CMAS and the SAT in grade 11. And in this particular example, what you see is that the student would reach English proficiency in 4 years, and then would move from a non-English proficient student initially to a limited English proficient student, likely in grades 2 through 4, to a fully English proficient student in grades 5 and 6, just resting in the monitor status. And so this is our example of a first grade student who would start, or a student who is a Spanish-speaking student who would start in first grade. Now, moving forward to our student B. Student B is in sixth grade. His or her home language survey once again reveals that the student speaks a language other than English. In this particular example, we've noted that the student speaks Vietnamese. And so as a result of this student having some experience in schooling in the past, the WAPT may show that the student is limited English proficient. And in looking at this example, for student B, as you move up in the academic strata, as Dr. Colesman mentioned, the distinction between understanding social language and academic language begins to get increasingly complex. So obviously what a student would need to know from an academic sense as a first grader is substantially less sophisticated than what a student would need to know as they progress into grade 6. And so in this example, what a student who is limited English proficient is capable of doing in general is that this student is able to use some general and some specific language in the content area. So in this mathematics example, mean, median, mode, measures of central tendency would be able to be used. In using expanded sentences and oral interactions or in written paragraphs, can speak and write solutions to problems. And then finally, using oral and written language with some errors that may impede the communication, but retain a great deal of the meaning when presented with oral and written descriptions and occasional visual and graphic support. So this student would be a little bit easier to understand as they have a different ability to be able to transfer information based upon historical understanding. And so as we look at the content standards, as well as the Colorado English Language Proficiency Standards, in this example, a student would relate the choice of measures of central and variability to shape the data distribution in the context which the data were gathered, which is a math standard. And then on the English Language Proficiency Standards, the student would select measures of central tendency based on the visual and graphic displays and oral descriptions of real-life situations. So you can see how those two standards relate closely together. And so the example that you'll see on the screen provides an application of actually how that would play itself out in a testing situation. And so as you see on this particular example, it shows a frequency table with the number of hours that each student in Ms. Claiborne's class spent volunteering in 1 week. And you know, the two-part question really focuses on the total number of hours that students volunteered, as well as the mean number of hours volunteered for that week. And so this again gets back into the example of understanding the complexity of academic language for what an 11-year-old or a sixth grader would be required to do. This is an ability to be able to provide some context. So obviously the example that we're using right now for this particular student is one that is limited English proficient, but obviously when placing that in the context of a student who is non-English proficient, the content standards continue to remain the same. And so this is a kind of a part of the experience for our English learners as they begin to progress through their academic careers. And so in looking at this student's example, once again, this is an example of this student's academic experience all the way through from sixth grade until the student's senior year in high school. And for this particular example, we noted that the student was able to reach English proficiency in 6 years, so not dissimilar to the student prior. What you see is that the student would take the WAPT when he or she first arrived to the school, and would continue the access exam until his or her junior year. Along with that, the student would continue to take the CMAS in grades 6, 7, and 8. As I mentioned previously, the PSAT in grades 9 and 10, as well as the CMAS SAT in grade 11. And so in this case, the student would reach fully English proficient by the time that he or she is a senior in high school, and during that year, that student would be on monitor status. And now getting into our final example, which is a bit more complex. This is our 15-year-old student whose home language is Somali. And as Dr. Colesman mentioned, this would be a student who had an experience with interrupted schooling. And in any of those examples or any of those situations, we find there becomes a different level of intensity that is required in order to make sure that support is needed for students who fall into that situation. So just like the others, home language survey would reveal that the student speaks a language other than English. And in this case, the WAPT would be non-English proficient. And so going back, looking at what an NEP can do, back to explaining again those using pictorial and graphic representations of the language in the content areas, responding to words and phrases or chunks of language when presented with one-step commands, directions, or choice yes-no questions and statements with interactive support, using oral language with errors that often impede meaning when presented with basic oral commands and directions, questions, simple statements, and interactive support. When thinking about that as it relates to a student is in this situation, whenever a student has interrupted schooling, as I mentioned previously, the content standards for a student in that grade are the content standards for a student in that grade. And so really trying to make sure that there is clarity in terms of how those students in that situation continue to get support. So in looking at the content standards, we want to make sure that in this example, this would be an example of what a content standard would be for a student in mathematics. And on this is a little bit more complicated to see because the text is a little bit small on the example, but I will read the standards in terms of representing data on two variables, two quantitative variables to show the scatter plot and describe the relationships, and then on this, organizing graphically displayed data from written directions and models in small groups. And really in looking at this question, you can see just in terms of what I explained in the standard, just the complexity of the language that is required to understand the meanings. And so, again, for a student who is non-English proficient, who is new to the country, and who may have interrupted schooling, this student may not be able to transfer the information that they've learned from mathematics throughout the course of their academic career. And so in this particular example, you can see students who may attend school until they would be what we refer to as third grade, and then may have some experience that interrupts that schooling, and then move to the United States and then come and begin to start up schooling. That gap in an academic experience makes it very difficult for that student to be able to transfer any knowledge that is gained over time, while a student whose age group peers would be continuing schooling throughout that time as well. So when you begin to talk about the totality of our English learners, this is where it can begin to get very complicated in terms of trying to explain how these groups or students who fall into this category are not necessarily monolithic, but come with them sort of a whole host of complexities in terms of what their experiences might have been in their native countries. And so in looking at this particular example of a student who has some interrupted experiences, really trying to make sure that on the assessment side, paying attention to a unique feature that the state of Colorado offers in terms of optional years of high school. And so in this example, the student is trying to continue to develop the academic language and the social language at the same time. And so continuing to take the access for 4 years from the first year of high school all the way to age 18 while taking the PSAT in grades 9 and 10, as well as the CMAS and SAT in grade 11. But again, the high schools could, if the district so chose, provide an opportunity for students to continue to develop additional academic experiences and academic language beyond the traditional senior year of high school. And so that opportunity does exist and is available for students, but really trying to find a way to make sure that the academic experience can be supported so that the students can continue to move forward and live productive and successful lives. And so at this point, what I will do is toss this back over to Dr. Colesman to begin to wrap up the presentation and talk to you a little bit more about what to look ahead.
So what we attempted to do today, you typically have to make a decision based on a small sliver of all of this information, and it usually is a pretty high-stakes kind of decision that you're making. What we wanted to do today is hopefully provide you with this bigger context grounded within the experience of different students to understand some certain things around how social language and academic language are interrelated but not necessarily predictors of one another, how our academic standards are held for all students. We want to make sure that all students have access to grade level content, and our English language proficiency standards are there to help teach the language skills to access that academic content. We talked a bit about the different assessments and how they are used to assess either content knowledge or language development, and how those work with respect to identifying an English learner and identifying their language development such that we can see their progression and when they're moving from non-English proficient to limited English proficiency over to fully full English proficiency, such that we can see how all of those work together to support kids to develop that language that they need to be successful in school. What we're going to be doing in our November presentation is to be thinking about, I gave you the example of Randy, and I had to be thinking about all of these things with respect to Randy's English language development and his understanding of academic language. So we're going to talk a little bit about what about educator preparation and what are those things that educators need to know and understand and be able to do in order to support English learners. And then thinking about the accountability system and about how our accountability system holds schools and districts accountable for ensuring that continued growth in both areas of English and academics. The one thing that I'll, before we open for some questions, is just give you, again, some more personal experience. As I started to learn more about supporting the language development of the increasing number of language learners that I was getting in my math class, what I started to realize was that I wasn't paying attention to the academic language that was used in my content area for any of my students. I wasn't spending the time to make sure that my students understood the difference between table and table as used within the math class. I wasn't clear about understanding that my students may have, when we talk about the word mean, median, and mode, well, what does mean mean? Because mean means different things in different content areas. And I wasn't paying attention to how that could be confusing for my students. So as I learned to better support my English learners and their academic language development, I actually got better about supporting all of my students and understanding the language of math, and that actually gave all of my students better access to the content that I wanted them to learn. So I think that, you know, as we think about all of the things that our English learners bring to the classroom, we can also think about how the skill base of our teachers can also expand as we learn how to better serve those students. So we do have a few minutes. We didn't talk for a full 90 minutes. I'm sure you're incredibly grateful for that. But we wanted to just make sure that if you have some questions that we can answer, we'll do our best to answer. But also remember that all of our content experts aren't here at this particular table. So some of us will need to, we might need to copy a couple questions down and get back to you. All right?
Board Member Flores.
I have lots of questions, but first of all, I have to make this statement. I want to ask Dr. Cobb, were you at Cherry Creek for several years?
Yes, I was.
Were you the director of curriculum?
Yes, I was.
And so you worked with teachers and directors and other people who worked in English language, and they didn't have a dual language. What kind of program would you consider that you had in Cherry Creek?
Sure. So the program in Cherry Creek focused primarily on co-teaching. That program was actually led by Dr. Holly Porter, who's the director of English language acquisition in the district. But there was a tremendous amount of effort and support that really kind of focused on trying to make sure that the English language development teacher, along with the content teacher, taught collaboratively
in the classroom. It wasn't a pullout.
Correct.
Okay. So one of the things that I just couldn't help but, although you said there's a difference between the social and the academic, I agree with you. I don't think most teachers understand that. And just like for you, some of them don't get to that point where they understand that they have to deal with the academic. And that parents really take their kids to school and want their kids to attend school so that they can get the academic, and that's very important. I think that
we need some questions because we're going to
well,
be short
yes,
on time.
Well, yes, I'm getting there. Good. I'm getting there. And so I think that if we give the children, the students, as you mentioned at the very beginning, that you called it a newcomers program, just like I think years ago we used to give Head Start or kids going into kindergarten a Head Start. And especially, I think that's a good way for English language learners to get that special language that they're going to need at the very beginning. So if we give them that, I don't think it's very difficult to teach the sounds and the letters. And for English, I think that's
Board Member Flores, let's get some more questions because you haven't asked a question.
You're really...
I'm sorry, we're just going to need to take
turns. No, you're cutting. You're just...
I'm going to give you another turn, so please organize your questions.
I am organizing my questions. I'm explaining something that I don't think you understand.
We'll get back to you. We'll get right back to you.
No,
Board Member Rankin.
This is absurd.
Please.
I was trying to explain something.
Please, question time. I will get back to you. Board Member Rankin, do you have questions?
I do. Page 19.
This is very rude.
They have, let's see, on the second, Access 2.0 measures English language proficiency, and the districts identify them as English learners until they are fully proficient. Do the districts use the same, for lack of a better word, cut scores? So that if a student was in one district, transferred to another, would he be able to start at the point where he left off with the other one? Or is this totally subjective to the district?
Madam?
Please.
So the Office of Culturally and Linguistically Diverse Education does set redesignation criteria, and it is with a cut score from the Access 2.0 results along with a body of evidence. So most of my answer to you is yes, there's one cut score, but each district gets to use their body of evidence. So it is possible that District A would have a more stringent body of evidence than District B, but the state sets the minimum cut score.
So it is subjective, according to the districts. I don't mean that in a negative.
It is subjective, yeah, according to the districts.
And on page 22, you have listed 1, 2, and 3. I don't know what that means.
On
is
the,
it a 20-point scale? Or?
Oh, yes, thank you. It is a 6-point scale. And the CLDE office has set redesignation criteria at a level 4.
Okay, that helps. And then on page 28, I have bunch of questions, but this is going to be my last one because these
we'll
are the most important.
After we've all had a chance.
This is to me the key of the whole presentation, the models that we use in Colorado. And what I'd like to know is in our office, in the department, we have a list, I'm sure, of all the different models that do exist in Colorado. Do we know which ones are more effective or more frequently used? I know those could be two different numbers. Do we do some kind of an evaluation of that throughout the state so we can say, hey, best practices, if a district doesn't know what to use, here's what.
Would you like me to address that partially?
Right, I think what Heather can do is talk about like what data we do collect. We can find out if we've done some analysis according to the outcomes of those different programs. But Heather will know a little bit more about the types of information that we collect.
Did you say if you have done some analysis? Or
right, I'm just not aware of that because we don't have all of the content people up at the table.
But we do have a list of the models so that a district that might not know quite what's out there would have access to. And you could help them choose?
Yes, we have a better list of models now with the new ESSA. So I can tell you what data is collected that we collect through the Access for ELL student demographic file. And previously, we only collected if they were in an English language development program that only utilized English, or if they were in an English language development program that utilized the native language, mm-hmm. or parent choice. So really, it didn't provide us with much information. But now with the new ESSA collection, we will be collecting the specific programs that you see there. So the collection from this year will be our first foundation in having that information to truly be able to do an analysis on the strength of programs. But previously, we didn't have enough information collected.
That's going to be very valuable.
Yes.
So Madam Chair, I'm going to ask it. Dr. Cobb has a point that I think would be really helpful to understand about when we think about different models, program models that districts might choose from.
So one of the things that I think is important to understand also is the reason why we showed the different students A, B, and C how those students interact with those models, I think, is also an important thing to understand. So, for instance, if a school district or location in Colorado happens to have a greater percentage of students who would fall into category C, as the student C example, that would then also have an impact in terms of how those models wind up creating an interpretation, because certainly the access scores would be one place of an opportunity to be able to give an example of how students are doing, but the content to which the students are being exposed and when they're being exposed to that content is also going to be a factor. And so, I want to always make sure that we offer a little bit of interpretive caution with that, because that was one of the reasons why we wanted to make sure that we talked about those three specific examples, because who attends, when they attend, how much background knowledge they have will also impact that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I so appreciate the inclusion, particularly of the model for student C, because when I toured Aurora Central prior to my election with Superintendent Munn, he mentioned that in some cases these students have had these interruptions to their studies before even coming here, in some cases with no English language skills. And because there are so many languages spoken there, they're having to sometimes do interpretation services over the telephone, which must be tremendously challenging when you may have one classroom with many different languages spoken. And then when you add to that the challenge of a transient population where, as he put it, I'll start the year with X number of students and I'll end the year with roughly X number of students and they won't be the same students, it's a tremendous challenge. So it's less of a question and more of a request that as we go into any future rounds of accountability clock hearings, when we're looking at these results for schools that fit that profile with lots of students like student C, it's helpful for me to have guidance in how to layer that consideration of those challenges onto the results that we see. Because as I left that tour, I just felt a tremendous sympathy for the challenges that they face there in trying to help make sure that those students are achieving as much progress as they can throughout the year. So less a question and a thanks for including that example and a plea for all the guidance that you can offer as we face the job of interpreting that data in rounds to come. Thank you.
Board Member Masnick.
One of my questions is, all students identified as NEP and LEP have to participate in access regardless. Is that by law?
Madam. Yes, the opt-out law did not include access for ELLs, but we understand and work with districts and tell them the highest priority is to have a relationship with the families and the students, and that they need to take into account parent request and do what they need to do.
My other question is, we have these programs which you say you will be able to provide us some data on how effective they are. What I'm interested in is how many districts are using these programs? I mean, how many students in Colorado are actually affected by these programs?
Right, so that's actually some information that we can follow up with you on. So definitely we can give you numbers on the program participation in those different models. There's always caution with that data because it's self-reported, and so it's not as clean as we would probably want it. But then we can also follow up with you in terms of outcomes, if whether or not we've done any analysis on that. So those will be two follow-up items that we'll do.
Board Member Goff, do you have any questions? Go.
I'll be quick. I think they're fairly simple. I wonder if you have a succinct, short definition of literacy. I'm asking this on behalf of the public and people who don't spend their majority of their time in this realm of discussion. Mm-hmm. I will say, first of all, thank you for today. Mm-hmm. I think it was very helpful in moving us for all of us forward on understanding acquisition versus the reading issue and the speaking and the mm-hmm. listening components that are involved in this. But any of you, if there's a two or three word key thing that can really delineate the word literacy from English proficiency. What part of it is that?
Well, I'll do a little piece, and then I'll just see if Heather wants to add to this. But literacy really pertains to the four domains of reading, writing, speaking, and listening. Literacy, right. But literacy also is composed of those things, reading, writing, speaking, listening. Those actually are the four areas of our literacy standards in the academic standards areas. Those also happen to be parts of language development because the language and literacy are very closely related, obviously.
Okay, thank you. The other one is, I've got two or three. I'm going to try to condense them. How are the other content areas, in addition to math, language arts, science, and social studies, how are they addressed in this as far as developing academic language skills? If you've got these kids that are involved in art or music, there is a body of language, vocabulary, that applies to those courses. So how are teachers and such being brought into that scope of development?
So the SELP standards, which were adopted from WIDA, have language of language arts, language of math, language of science, and language of social studies, and they focus on those four cores, but they do have resources to support educators in how would you use language supports in the other contents, but we don't have any specific assessment materials of language of music or language of art.
Yeah. Do you happen to know if there's work going on to develop some of that? I'm right today on my mind. First I said art and whatever else I said, but really on my mind today is physical education, perhaps, and any other content area. This would pertain, I would assume, particularly to our 15-year-old, and what other menu options are available to that student. Mm-hmm. So just rhetorical, okay. Take it at that, it's fine. And then one other, any idea of what the percentage is of kids who are not in a language instruction program by parent choice? Is
that's
there,
something that we
are
can
there
follow
some
up.
Or
we,
you know,
we could find that out.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the rationale such.
Yep.
And then kind of related to that is what do we know now about why would a district deny a parent request to I may think of something else, but there's been reference made to actually, I'll save it for later. I think it applies to something.
It applies to the next
yes,
discussion.
as I said that.
But now you own it. You get to ask it for
yeah, I will.
We
I will.
Were all
I'm happy
ask
to.
It, but
I'm
now
sorry.
Deb gets to ask it.
Thank you. Backing me up.
Okay, I just have a couple questions. I hope they're short. The WAPT, does it vary depending on the age of the child? Or
yeah.
Is it a test that's identical for all kids?
No, it is grade level. It is. Okay. There's a kindergarten assessment. There's a grade level cluster of 1-2, grade level cluster of 3-5, a grade level cluster of 6-8, and then a cluster for 9-12. And then there's guidance on how to score it for the grade that the student is in.
Okay. And if you have a student who is identified as illiterate, I believe that was the word that was used, is then the assessment given only orally? I mean, I'm trying to visualize as a youngster, no matter what age, who is not reading, how do we assess the level of English limitation?
The assessment is still presented for the four language domains of speaking, listening, reading, and writing. And it is adaptive, so if the student couldn't read, they would still have the opportunity to engage with, so at a lower level, the student could have something read to them that then they would read to them. would read back. And so it's still presented, but there's guidance on how to stop if it's not appropriate for the student.
The assessment 2.0, when is that administered? Same time every year?
Access 2.0 is a 5-week window, and it opens on the second Monday of January.
It's prior to the other assessments that are annual assessments.
Yes.
That come from the state. Okay. And then in the research that relates to the length of time that it takes a student to acquire English, are there differences depending on the age at which youngsters enter the limited English programs?
I do not know the answer to that. I know a lot of research has been done on that within CDE, within the accountability office, and I would defer to letting them be the experts on that.
Okay, because in your examples, you have all different time spans, et cetera. Okay, questions? Dr. Flores.
It doesn't have to be. This is a discussion. It can be a discussion, too. Two minutes, please. I don't think I could say anything in 2 minutes.
Board Member Flores, we are out of time, and so we'd appreciate if you'd help us.
I know, but I'm trying to get to the crux of this and for understanding this. And I think there's a major fallacy, and the major fallacy is that school is about literacy, decoding. And in this case, it's the same thing with second language learners. They're going to have to be proficient in decoding the English language. So that's where the emphasis should be, in decoding English. And it's much easier for an older kid to decode than a younger kid. And just as we have these programs for kids in kindergarten to be able to decode so that they can read by first grade, that should be the object of, I think, any second language program. And because there are two different things, being able to assess whether they speak is different. And actually, you should forget that. The teacher should really hone in on the cognitive part of it, the academic part of it, and that is literacy and the acquisition of knowledge, and that is through reading. That is what we really should think about. And if we think about and do that, I think we will be successful. And one of the problems that we have here in Colorado is that we haven't done that. We haven't honed in on the literacy and decoding we do it for English language learners, but we don't do it for second language learners. And it's the same thing. They're going in there to be literate, to decode so that they will be able to then consume knowledge and acquire all those standards and all that information that they need. So we need to think about that. And when I think most teachers, as you said, Dr. Coltzman, they do. Many of them who have not had the training listen to what a kid says and really bases almost all their judgment on that and not on cognitive and reading. And you can have a 2- and a 3-year-old who will be doing fantastic and on time will be reading by third grade if you keep with the literacy and the decoding and do much better.
Thank you, Dr. Flores.
Maybe excel than the English speaking people, because that's what we did in Texas.
Board Member Rankin. Thank you.
I have a question about the PSAT 910 and SAT on 11. Within the district, if they are literate enough to take those tests, are those tests just factored into what the school tests are, or is that a separate category?
Madam, are you asking me if those results are factored into the school accountability?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they are.
Along with everybody else's, as if they're, okay, that was my first question. The last one is, I would really appreciate, since I know you're gonna come back at us again, the acronyms. Mr. Chapman, I appreciate the ones you have, but there have been many, many more in this presentation that are not described. And I would like it for this presentation and also the one in November, if you could have, and if there are any in the previous one, because I think these apply more to this particular group of students, and sometimes I'm lost.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that suggestion.
Board Member Flores. And the state and federal laws pertaining to English language learners, I think if you did a description of what these laws are and what they mean for English language learners and share it not only with the board but with everybody in the state, superintendents and teachers, I think that would be very, very valuable.
Thank you.
And we should also have the McKinley-Vento Act in there, which has been reenacted in 2015. Mm-hmm. Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much. It was a great presentation.
Thank you. We have a parting gift for you, just so that you know. Each of you gets your own, it's not framed, but overview.
But
of,
we may frame them if
yes,
we wish.
Yes, you may. Yes.
Thank you.
They make great holiday gifts, too. So so this is an overview of the assessments as well, just so that you kind of have it all in one place.
Thank you. That's great. So we are behind schedule. However, I'm going to call, please, a five-minute break. And then we'll begin the hearing. My apologies to those folks who expected us to be on time. State Board of Education will now conduct a public rulemaking hearing for the rules for the administration of the Colorado Reading to Ensure Academic Development, READ Act. State Board voted to approve the notice of rulemaking on its August 16, 2017 board meeting. A hearing to promulgate these rules was made known through public notice on September 10, 2017 through the Colorado Register and by State Board notice on October 4, 2017. The State Board is authorized to promulgate these rules pursuant to 22-2-107-1CCRS. Commissioner, is staff prepared to provide an overview?
Yes, thank you. I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Kolsman, Dr. Cobb, and Alex Frazier.
Thank you, Commissioner, Madam Chair, members of the board. Up at the table with me today are Dr. Floyd Cobb, who you just had the pleasure of having some time with, and then also a new staff member I want to introduce, new to you but not new to us, Alex Frazier, who is in our Office of Literacy. As you recall, Elisa Dorman, our Executive Director of Literacy, has moved, and so we're working on getting that position posted and filled, and so Alex is here to ensure that if we have a specific literacy-related question, we have that content knowledge. So today, our purpose is to conduct a rulemaking hearing. I want to quickly orient you to your materials. You have a memo for this agenda item. You also have an annotated version of the rules. We call that the bubble version because there's some bubbles off to the side with some comments, and we'll be using referring to that version. You also have a copy of the authorizing statute, House Bill 171160, which passed in this recent legislative session, and you have a side-by-side comparison of rule to statute. Just also that, so that you're aware, I'll be taking the majority of what we do today, but I have my two phone-a-friends on either side of me, so just so that you're aware. What we'll do today is just a very, very brief presentation. We're already a quarter of the way through because we're on slide 2 of 4. We're going to walk through the rules and make sure that you're aware of the different pieces of the rules and provide some context for you. We'll present the written public comments. And then that following that will be a time for the oral public comments, followed by Q&A from board members, and followed by a vote. So just very briefly, the background information, House Bill 1160, which passed in this latest legislative session, authorized local education providers to determine the language in which a student who is an English learner takes reading assessments in kindergarten through third grade. So again, this is with respect to the READ Act. Currently, districts can opt through our through rule, opt to assess students in Spanish for students receiving their literacy instruction in English and Spanish. If an English learner is assessed in their native language, the LEP must notify the parents in writing, at which point the child's English language development that the district will assess the student in English. So as you recall, there were the six levels of language development that Heather Villalobos indicated. Parents need to identify parents in writing at which language level they will start to transition the student into assessing in reading in English. Currently, right now, there is no statute that pertains to this parent notification. The third aspect of 1160 was that when an English learner is determined to be partially proficient in English by the LEP, the district shall ensure that the student is assessed at least once in English. So this leaves the level of English on that scale of 1 to 6 up to the district to determine at which point they transition into assessing in English. So keep in mind that that is entirely at the district level within statute. Currently, state board rules require that at least one assessment occur in English throughout the year, at one point throughout the year. And finally, 1160 indicated that LEPs may also assess an English learner in English at the request of a parent. Currently, there's no specific rule or law that pertains to that. Right now, what I'd like to be able to do is walk you through the annotated version of the rules. The reason I wanted to do this is there are some minor technical changes that occurred between the August meeting and right now. I wanted to make sure you were really clear about where those are. There is one change related to a content issue that I want to explain why that change is being recommended. And finally, there is one change in response to board member discussion at the August notice of rulemaking. So what I'll do is sequentially go through the rules through our bubbles. So that was bubble one. The second bubble.
Chair.
Yes.
So are we going to be able to ask questions as she's talking?
If need be, yes.
Okay.
In order to clarify it.
Yeah. Sure. Does this get... Yes, it does. Is there anything that I need to clarify right now? Because I know I went through 1160 pretty quickly.
Probably, but...
Okay. As those questions come up, I'll be happy to clarify. So as we look at within the rules, section 1.0, you'll notice that there is a section that's being added through this rulemaking process. That is the text... that is underlined and in blue. You'll notice that we have a technical piece here. We just needed to clean up the language. We had the language R required by. We didn't need that particular phrase. So we're just seeking to remove that for clarity. We're considering that a technical fix or a technical change. The rest of the revisions to the rules pertaining to alignment with 1160 all occur in section 3.0 of existing rule, and then adds another section to rule, which is section 13. So we're going to transition and look at section 3.0.
I think we're lost.
Okay, so we're looking at the annotated version of the rules. So it's a red line or blue line or...
Yours looks different than mine.
Depends on your computer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What?
So if you look at a track changes versions of the rules, and off to the right, there's a column with some comment bubbles. I have one more set of bubbles than you that's guiding me.
So that's why yours looks different.
Yes, it looks slightly different. Page one.
Okay.
This is
what we have.
I have this much red line. You have substantially less. Right?
Yeah, yours is red versus mine is blue.
Oh, yours is.
Yeah. If we could make Microsoft Word like always do the same color, or maybe if we learned how to do that, that would even be better. So I apologize for that confusion. So I think everyone has the same document right now. Is that right?
We hope so.
Okay. We'll find out in a moment. So we're going to switch over to page 2 of the draft rule document. And we're in section 3.00, which is the section pertaining to assessments with respect to the READ Act. Right. So we're going to, unfortunately, as we go sequentially, we're going to dive into probably a more substantial piece that I'll need to explain. And so I'm hoping my goal is to be really clear. Section 3.04, which exists right now in rule.
Did you make any modifications to the rules based on comments?
No, we did not make any based on public comments. We have made, we've made one change at the board comments from the August meeting.
Right, but so nothing, did we receive significant public comment, and what was the time frame of that?
So we did receive comments, and you should have them as part of your packet, and we have a summary document of those.
That I don't.
We handed them out this morning.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. I'm behind. Okay.
So we'll spend, we've allotted some time to go through those as well, because they do address some of the areas that state board members have requested be included in rule. So we'll go over that as okay. After we kind of go over the rules. Does that
Thank
feel
you.
Right?
Okay.
So in section 3.04, which currently exists in rule, this indicates that when students receive their literacy instruction in both English and Spanish, that the local education provider may opt to use a reading assessment in Spanish to determine whether a student has a significant reading deficiency. But it indicates that in these instances, students shall also be assessed once annually using a state board approved reading assessment in English for the purposes of informing reading instruction and intervention services. So right now, current rule indicates that regardless of district choice, districts must assess at least once in English.
Is that, are those results recorded? At all?
No, not necessarily.
Could
they
you
may
repeat
be.
That? I'm sorry.
The Ms. Masnick asked whether or not those results are reported, and currently it would depend, because if a district uses an English assessment to determine a significant reading deficiency, then they would submit that score. If they just use it to monitor their reading ability in English, they don't necessarily do so. So this is current practice.
Right. To clarify, if a school or district decides to use the native language assessment to determine whether they have a deficiency, that of course is reported. But if they go ahead and also assess them in English, that's not reported.
In current practice, you are correct. That doesn't mean that practice cannot change.
But if we require it, if we require them to test in English, shouldn't that be reported?
Currently, the rules don't require that.
And if a parent asks, shouldn't that be reported?
So actually, through this rulemaking process, there were some questions, exactly the questions that you have here, were some of the additions to the proposed rules or the revisions to the rules that came from board members, which is actually in section 13 as well as section, actually it's all in section 13.00. So those are some things that board members have expressed a desire to change, and those changes are included in the draft rules.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. The one piece is, as we read through this, is at face appears at odds with 1160. Because this 3.04 rule indicates that districts shall at least assess once in English, whereas 1160 authorizes the district to determine the language of assessment, period. So we had wondered whether or not that section should be stricken or not. But as further closer examination, we determined that section actually does pertain to, if you think back to when Dr. Cobb explained a dual language program, if you have a two-way immersion program, you may have, I'll give an example that's a Chinese immersion program that has native Chinese speakers who are learning English and are being taught in both English and Chinese, and you might have, you'll have native English speakers in there who are learning Chinese and English. So there are some dual two-way immersion programs which have native speakers of different languages. What this does this allows that if I'm in a Chinese immersion program as a native English speaker, it requires that districts at least assess me in English once in a while, or at least once a year. So imagine I'm a native English speaker, I'm a second grader, my parents have placed me in a dual language program. This rule requires that school to at least assess me once in English.
But again, that's not reported.
In this case...
That's just internal.
In this case, it still would be reported because we don't have a Chinese assessment. So that would be the only score worth a report. Yeah. So I specifically chose that example for that reason. Okay. And for that reason, we're saying that it seems important to ensure that students in a dual language program still are assessed at least once in English. And so we are recommending the addition that this section shall not apply to a student who is an English learner. And the reason is because 1160 indicates that that English assessment is left at the discretion of the district. Is that clear? Okay. So the next section is a little bit easier. So that was the hardest one. You feel good moving on? Okay, good. Section 3.05, all of the beginning language in Rule 3.05 come directly or almost directly from statute, and this pertains to authorizing LEPs to determine the language in which a student who is an English learner takes a reading assessment in kindergarten through third grade. And it also pertains to the point that LEPs may assess an English learner in English at the request of a parent. I want to draw your attention to the very last two sentences in 3.05A. The last two sentences in 3.05A were added at the request of board members. And this is what the addition indicates. If the local education provider denies the parent request to administer an assessment in English, the local education provider will provide an opportunity for the parent to appeal that decision to an individual or committee designated by the LEP. If the appeal is denied, the local education provider shall explain the rationale for the decision verbally and in writing. So the law indicates that districts may respond to a parent request, and board members have asked that we put into rule an appeal process for a parent who is denied that request, and that if a parent's appeal is denied, that there's a rationale given. So that's a section that was added at the request of board members.
But there's no timelines.
There isn't a timeline here. However, in the reporting section, section 13.00 is all of district reporting requirements, and so we put in there that annual reporting of that information.
Those have to be put in.
That's correct. So section 3.05B, which begins on page 2 and goes on to page 3, indicates that relates to the second and third bullet points on the slide, which is that if an English learner is assessed in their native language, the LEP must notify the parent in writing, at which point in the English language development of the child, the district will assess in English. And when the English learner is determined to be partially proficient in English by the LEP, the district shall ensure that the student is assessed at least once in English. This section is almost entirely from statute, and there are no additions with respect to board member requests. So this is almost verbatim from statute. So the final section is the district reporting requirements. And you'll see what is in black font is what originally existed in section 13.00, and the either blue or red font additions are what are being changed a result of this rulemaking process. The first piece that I'll draw your attention to is there is one technical piece in the introductory statement for 13.01 that we have made one more edit to since what you saw in August. During this process, we were able to remove the beginning in the 2012-2013 school year because it was no longer relevant. Thought it was a great time to clean that piece up because it was no longer needed. But one piece that we didn't recognize at that point is a technical piece. It said, during the collection window established by the Education Data Advisory Committee. Technically, that's not who establishes the data collection window. So we also thought it was a good opportunity to delete that piece. And that was not part of the August rulemaking notice. The next rule change is 13.01D. And this was part of the August rulemaking notice, which was added at the request of board members. Here's the interim assessment score that must be submitted to the department. Board members requested that if the LEP is required to administer at least one assessment in English, either because the student has demonstrated at least partially proficient in English or because the student's parent has requested the student to be assessed in English, the LEP must submit the student's score on the English assessment. So that was added at board member request. That was in the August rulemaking notice. So that has not
Board
changed.
Board Member Rankin.
I have a question about that, and it's a similar question that I asked earlier. Is this uniform, or is this subjective, district to district?
So that's a good question. So so you'll recall that the access test provides a level of reading, or at least their understanding of the language of reading, from one to six. Mm-hmm. So that part is not subjective. That's provided by the assessment tool. What does become subjective is what's in House Bill 1160. Because if you notice the third bullet point that summarizes 1160 on the slide says, when an English learner is determined to be partially proficient in English by the LEP. So the LEP, by statute, is allowed to determine which level would be considered partially proficient. And typically as well, districts would use a body of evidence. Okay.
Do we currently have any of that information? Do we know what districts are doing to determine proficiency, partial proficiency?
So the challenge with the statute is it uses a term partially proficient, which is not actually even one of the indicators as of the within the access assessment. So the descriptors, none of the descriptors are partially proficient. So that's one piece. The second piece is because this hasn't been implemented yet, we don't know which level they will choose. However, that does not preclude the department from providing districts guidance on, you know, that it might be whatever language level that from our professional opinion would be the best level to start transitioning into English. We can absolutely do that, but of course we couldn't require that. We know that districts typically appreciate having some guidance on pieces like that, but they wouldn't be held to it. So the very last section in 13.0, in the district reporting requirements, is 13.02, and this section was added entirely at the request of board members. And 13.02A and 13.02B were part of the August notice of rulemaking. 13.02C was added as a result of discussion at the August board meeting. So I'll explain each of them. 13.02A indicates that if an LEP administers an assessment in a student's native language, a copy of the communication sent to students' parents described in 3.05B of these rules. So we're asking districts to actually submit a copy of the communication that's sent to parents around which language of assessment that they're doing. Now, it would not be our intent that we would get each individual one, especially typically districts send out a blanket communication. 13.02B, if the LEP administers an assessment in the student's native language and the student is assessed only in the student's native language, the LEP must submit the number of years that the student has been assessed only in the student's native language. So this is the notion of how long has the student been assessed in perhaps only Spanish, I think was the request. Right now that's the only native language that we have assessments for assessing. And finally, at the result of the August rulemaking hearing, 13.02C was added to respond to board member comments. If an LEP administers an assessment in a student's native language and a parent's request to administer an assessment in English is denied, the LEP must submit the number of years that such a parent request for that student has been denied, with the notion of if a parent is continually denied that request, board members request a desire to know about that. So that gives you a sense of what's in proposed rule. We can go over some answers to that, then we'll go over some public feedback.
So if I may interject first, I would appreciate if Counselor Tolson would tell us whether this is going to come back to us if we include, I mean, I think our general wish has been not to put things in rules that aren't in legislation. I believe that was the direction to staff some time ago. In this particular case, it's been the feeling that there's not enough in the legislation for the benefit of kids. We need more. This is the Groundhog Day bill that just keeps coming back and keeps coming back. So I guess I'd like to have a guess whether that's what's going to happen here or whether we are within our discretion to be adding these things.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. I appreciate your use of the term guess because certainly nobody's crystal ball is perfect, particularly as it relates to OLLS. But one thing we do know with this particular piece of legislation was a product, a little bit of a tug of war, perhaps the Groundhog Day that you mentioned, coming back with a focus on discretion being left at the LEP level and that READ Act assessments be tied to more to literacy than to language acquisition. So we sort of know that that's the framework in which this is back in our laps. There are a couple of areas that I think are the most vulnerable in terms of review at the General Assembly. One is the appeal process requirement only because it isn't anywhere within the statute, and so it becomes one of those mandates to local government which can be subject to some level of additional scrutiny, and because there isn't an aspect in terms of the outcome of that that relates to the board's general oversight authority regarding READ Act implementation, which is primarily about setting, selecting assessments and setting proficiency standards and some of those things that are set out in the statute. The other area that probably would be subject to some of that same scrutiny and pushback is that additional reporting requirement in 1302. When you look at the statute that outlines the board's rulemaking authority regarding READ Act reporting requirements in particular, it talks about making rules around the, quote, time frames and procedures for reporting the information required by statute. And it doesn't really discuss and deciding to have some other things reported. You know, the reporting requirements as set forth in statute are tied to a specific getting a snapshot of student proficiency and making reports to the General Assembly. This is a bit of a square peg in a round hole against that backdrop. I do think the one other edit that's in there, which is about whether or not a district that tests in both languages, which one they report, I think that's within the discretion of the board. And it just may, as a policy matter, if the board decides as a policy matter we want to encourage districts to accommodate testing in English, it may produce the opposite result because it would require that the English results be factored in for accountability purposes, and that's certainly not a grand incentive, but that's a policy judgment for you all to make. I hope that helps.
So assuming that we pass this as written, odds are somewhat that we'll see it again.
If I were in Las Vegas and putting money down, that would be where my wager would be. Yes.
Okay. And then I have one other question, then we'll go around the table, because it might be helpful for everybody. And that is, having served on a board and looking at budgets, there are additional funds that are allocated to English language learners. I don't remember if they're federal funds or state funds or both. Is there an incentive, a financial incentive, for districts to possibly overstate in this discretionary piece that my colleague mentions, that it's not really cut and dry by a score, but it's plus other evidence? Is there a financial incentive for districts to have more non-English profession students, financial?
I do not know the answer to that question. I don't know if, okay, if we have anyone in the audience who knows.
We can save that for later, but it's something that sort of comes to me as a potential, especially since it's not black and white. Okay. So let me go down the line. Ms. Goff, do you have some questions?
No, I'm going to pass along because I'm
trying to get re-grounded
where we are now with what I asked earlier today.
Okay, Board Member Masnick?
I don't have any questions right now either.
No? Sorry. You're next.
Okay, and, well, there's no page numbers. It's page two, though. Can we have a do-over on what we might have done in August? Because if it says the parents have a right to appeal, where it says on 1305, local education provider denies the parent request to administer an assessment in English, I would like to strike the appeal part because it's not in the law and just go down to the part where it continues, the local education provider shall explain the rationale for the decision verbally and in writing. Now, let me tell you why I'm thinking this. Because when I finished reading this on this go-around, I thought, now we're looking for a number of students that repeatedly were denied, or right, parents that were repeatedly denied having English being tested of their student. Then we have another set. Maybe the parent got denied and they don't know they can appeal or don't understand it, so they left that alone. Then we have another group that goes to appeal if it's denied, and it goes back to a committee selected within the local education. I kind of feel that the option of them getting tested in English is not going to work even that second time around. So I would like to see that out of the law, and then we can have a real clear-cut picture of how many are denied, if in fact there are. And maybe they're all coming from one district, but maybe it's because they have more English language learners. I don't know the reasoning. But as long as the law doesn't require it, do we have the opportunity to strike that now? Less state down mandates on our schools.
So my understanding through the rulemaking process is that now is actually the open time when you can make some motions to strike portions of the draft rules as presented. I think we're still in discussion phase right now, though.
Yeah. Did you want to make a comment?
I did not. Dr. Coltman's got that right, yes.
Okay. Dr. Flores.
I think parents have the right to request that their children learn the language of the school, the language of this country.
Yeah, we can.
And I think that sometimes they will be fought by the district. And I think that language is so much a part of us. And when parents want their kids to learn the language of this country, and they will be responsible for the language at home, I think we need to give them that right. And districts shouldn't fight them on this. I know we're talking about which the district, I don't even think the district should have
have a say in this. If the parents want their kids to go to school and learn the language of this country, and they will help them at home. I mean, it's the same thing. An English learner comes to school to be literate and to learn. A second language learner comes for the same reason. And we should not deny the parent's wish if the parent wants their kid to be in an English classroom. We should not deny that. And we should provide them with the necessary help that they need to be successful, including being able to provide teachers that are able to do that, to teach English as a second language. And I think that's the big problem that we're seeing from the feds coming to us and saying that. And I mean, we have a court. Many of our districts are under court order just for that reason, that we're not providing kids that opportunity. And I hear it all the time. I hear it from kids in my district in Denver, that they want their kids to learn English. When they go to school, they want their kids to be placed in an English language classroom, because they will be responsible for learning, teaching their language. It's kind of almost an inviolable rule that we should give parents. Parents have the right to decide. And I think it's too easy for a district like Denver to get teachers that they pay half as much, who teach only the student's native language, and preclude the student from learning the language of this country, which is so important to them, you know, financially, mm-hmm. And to get ahead, and to give them an equal opportunity to everything that's good in this country.
Thank you. Board thank Member you. Durham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think perhaps to help Ms. Tolleson when it comes time to defend this is that we have an obligation under the statute to report to the legislature progress and the status of students under the READ Act. We can't meet that. We cannot meet our statutory responsibility to report without adequate information. And I think particularly, and I think we should state on the record, that 13.02B, that the local education provider must submit the number of years the student's been assessed only in the student's native language. That number provides this board with information that identifies the failure of a local education provider to adequately move a student forward and make them, even by the district's definition, partially proficient in English. And I think while this statute allows the district to define partially proficient any way they want, if they define it in such a way to game the system, and I do believe there is extra funding for gaming the system, that should be called to the attention of the General Assembly, and I think we have an obligation to collect this information so that we can properly report to the General Assembly on if there is a student or a large number of students that have 3, 4, 5 years of failure to become partially proficient in English. Someone needs to know that, and certainly this board should know that, and I think absolutely the legislature should be informed. So I think we have adequate rationale under our reporting requirements to request this information. If it's turned down, at least then it will give us the opportunity to inform the legislature about what information they will not receive.
So here's what I'm not disagreeing with you, but I am wondering whether we are using, again, the READ Act to assess acquisition of English proficiency, mm-hmm. which is tested by the access point too. I learned one thing today.
School's about literacy.
What do you mean?
My point is that the READ Act is designed to identify
a reading deficiency. Board Member Durham's concern, which I share, is how fast are kids acquiring knowledge of English? And that's what is assessed by...
That would include reading,
yeah.
Not well, just language.
Reading, this could be dyslexia. This could may not even... In other words, there are two very different assessments, and the way it's been explained to me, they measure different things. So my next question, and we're not on the accountability piece of the second language project, but I'm wondering if that isn't where we as a board should be looking very, very carefully at our school district's data, and I'm assuming that they are required to share that data so that we don't have kids who are for 4 years not proficient on the access to. Thank you. Go ahead.
If I might respond, Madam Chair, it's as I think you're aware, we had at least one sponsor of this bill, Senator Johnson, state that this wasn't about English language acquisition. I've talked to a number of people who were involved intimately with the bill, and they believe it was
okay.
About that. Now, I understand it's politically correct not to care whether people can speak English or not, and that some districts in this state apparently think that's a positive, that their students can't speak English and continue to refuse to report those statistics. That's entirely up to them. But I don't think this board should sit idly by and accept that interpretation that the READ Act has nothing to do with English, because there is significant controversy about whether or not that's the case. And I think we can legitimately express our opinion as to whether it is about the acquisition of English to at least some extent. And to your specific point, if a child is dyslexic, a child is just as dyslexic in Spanish as they are in English. So you will get the same result that they can't read if that's the cause.
Well, that's exactly my point.
Yeah.
That is
so it doesn't make any difference which language they're not reading in.
But statistics are statistics. And knowing how many years, you can give all
totally
kinds of meaning
I
to
totally
that.
Agree with you guys. I'm just suggesting that where we're looking might be the wrong assessment. Maybe we have not been paying enough attention to the results of the access to, in terms of single students, how many years they end up with the same NEP status based on the assessments. Mm-hmm. It's just a different piece.
But literacy, they learn through literacy after third grade. If you're not reading in English, you're not going to do very well in school in life.
No, I'm not arguing that.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So I understand the ongoing debate over English language proficiency and significant reading deficiency. But we're dealing with READ Act, mm-hmm. which is about are they able to read at a proficient level? Mm-hmm. And they may be being tested in their native language initially, but is it not the goal, whether you want your child to be bilingual or not, you still... It's still a measure of success that they're able to read in English. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't understand why that's controversial. I think that the public and parents want to know how many years a child has been tested in their native language as opposed to English. Are they making any progress on learning English, whether they're reading well in their own language or not? So I don't see why that's controversial, and I'm also, maybe this is a legislative problem, and I'm not sure it will be solved over there, because I'm not sure what people's motivations are, but I just find it a bit outrageous that there's a lot of funding tied to the READ Act, and I find it outrageous that there's any suggestion that wanting to know about how they're progressing in learning to read in English, that that's somehow a bridge too far for the public or parents to know, that's outrageous. Of course they deserve to know. A lot of money is going to this. Is it working? Are we producing English readers? That's it. I mean, like I said, it may not happen over at the legislature for reasons I don't understand, but I would like this board to do what it can.
Board Member Goff, you had another question.
Her iPad is ringing. She needs
better
to
than
apologize.
Your phone
spirit. I'm that so sorry. I didn't silence my iPad. For what it's worth, the original READ Act wasn't that 1338. Wasn't that the name of the bill? The original
1238.
The original READ Act bill. Well, you know, hindsight is so clear, but it seemed at the time that it was a lot clearer. There was not so much discussion around the reading versus acquisition needed to read. That gets into real muddy water. I know that this board had at least informal opinions from the Attorney General's office at the time about some guidance, some advice on what the law actually said, and also what the board's authority was around the original talks we were having at that time around the assessment issue of it and the measurement and so forth. So I would draw us back to that fact that thank you for your assistance, and we've been there, done that. So in my retrospective, the other thing is I guess it does bring to bear the question I asked probably out of place earlier today, but if we're talking READ Act, which applies only to K-3, correct?
That's correct.
Age range. Mm-hmm. And you have, and we have an English learner population that is filled with newcomer students. All right, so you've got kids coming in, brand new, first year. Where is the record of how many years they may have been denied taking the test in English? I mean, you can only accumulate, in my way of thinking, you can only accumulate 4 years where that might be a possibility. If someone's denied that opportunity. I don't feel that right now as being anywhere near related to what the law says. So I'm hesitant to go outside the statute this far. And particularly because it does put another burden, so to speak, on districts and or the department and or families perhaps, about keeping track of how many years that may have happened, and then you add on an appeal process, which is not spelled out in the statutory language, and just we're not thinking ahead about, we're thinking too far beyond what the actual READ Act is doing, and I'm not going to talk about the controversy between what is it dealing with, whether it's reading or whether it's language acquisition. It's the idea of what is the time, the technicalities? What's the time frame of this? What's the process for this? How would a district know, for example, how would anybody know if you've got brand new kids at the elementary level, how would you know if some place has denied them the chance to give a test in English? Where does that come from if they're brand new to your district? I just see that as kind of muddying the waters, and I'm in a balance. I'll take the balance between what Ms. Rankin said earlier about there's got to be a happy medium in here about how you adjust this. But to add in an appeal to the law, to the statutory language, I'm not a fan of that anyway. So it won't be today.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I think in the literature of reading and languages, you don't have dyslexia in Spanish. You really don't. I mean, there's a correlation between the letter and the sound that it's equivalent. I mean, it is just... just, and I think in French, you probably know this. If
there are some stuff.
There are some studies, but really not. We, in English, English is completely different. I mean, it is a mixture of all so many languages, and we have so many rules for this, how you pronounce F, is it F, PH? I mean, there are so many different exceptions to letters and symbols that we have that it's easy. We have, English has the most dyslexia in all. So if we don't get to English reading, we won't know. Spanish is not going to give you, you know, it's not going to give you information about a child having problems. And it's English that we want to get the child to because of the sake of literacy. And literacy so that the child can learn in the language that he can, you know, be successful in life, get a job, and read and have harmony, enjoy, you know, the language. And parents do teach their kids in their native language. I know that where I came from, that was just a given. I mean, that's why people are still in New Mexico, in Arizona, in Texas, you have, it's a bilingual country. And so that is just done normally. I was, well, not no, giving I'm, you any examples, but
Madam Chair.
I went to school already literate in my language. So English is what my parents wanted me to get in school. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. May I?
Board Member Goff.
Thank you. No, I agree. I probably was not clear enough in expressing that I'm trying to keep the academic, the content, the teaching separate from this process right now as laid out in the law. I totally agree that I can't help but come back to the original question, which consider it rhetorical at your will. It's fine. I want to know why would any local education provider deny a request of a parent who wants to have the test taken in English. I don't understand that. No, I don't know.
Really,
I'm saying, why did that come up at some point in our conversation? Mm-hmm. Why has that become an issue? Because the whole thing, excuse me,
can
puberty, finally.
May I just respond to that after you finish speaking?
I'm finished.
Okay. I think one of the things that happened in Colorado is that they were denied, these are Hispanics who lived in this country forever and ever, and I learned this from university people who, you know, teach Spanish and such, and it was so bad here, that they were struck in school, they were denied speaking their own language, that indeed they don't speak it. They may have, parents just changed over, and the school was so, if anybody spoke Spanish or kept it, they didn't learn it. In fact, they forgot it because they were so badly hurt at school, and they were shunned, and so they didn't learn it. And now they want everybody to learn it. And that's fine. I mean, I think you should have. In fact, I think these kids who should have something in culture in every class, and I'm sorry, during the week, I mean, I know that I went to, and I learned Saturday. I went to school on Saturday to learn Spanish, and that was at church. And so I think that's so important to have that. We should not eradicate a language, and I think that's what happened in Colorado, that people tried so hard to eradicate Spanish that people had terrible feelings about it. And now they're older, they're aware that, you know, this is their language, and they want to have it be part and not completely, you know, dismissed at all, and they want young kids to have an opportunity to learn that second language that's been their history. And I think they have that right. And they should also have the opportunity to learn English. And parents have the right, again I say it, parents have the right to decide which language they want their kids to learn. And usually in what's been happening here is they don't have the right to learn English in the school early enough when it is most efficacious. Thank you.
Dr. Colesman, you were going to also include some feedback on the comments that we've received?
That's correct.
I think that was our next step.
You're right. So within your packet of materials, you'll see a response to written comments on READ Act rule revisions document. And that document includes on the left-hand side kind of the specific comments. Now, this might be confused with we do have a side-by-side document of rule to law. So make sure you're looking at the document with the header of responses to written comments. We received two letters. One was from Trish Krasniak from the Charter School Institute. There are a few points that Ms. Krasniak makes. A couple of them we've clarified here. But I'll just summarize that the two comments that she had with respect to Section 13.00 around reporting are relevant to the discussion that you have today. She gives you a perspective about the impact of that additional collection at the local level. The other letter that we received was a letter, a combined letter from CASB, CASE, and the Rural Alliance. And you'll see the three main points that they make, and each of those also relate to that data collection piece in Section 13.02 regarding the impact at the local level. So I would just draw your attention to those comments because they relate to the discussion that you've been having.
Thank you. And now we'll have some comments, please. Is Kathy Shannon here? You are so patient. Thank you, Kathy. That's fine.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the State Board. My name is Kathy Shannon. I'm the Legal and Policy Counsel for the Colorado Association of School Boards. And I'm here testifying on behalf of a number of educational organizations, CASB, where I work, the Colorado Association of School Executives, and called CASE, and also the Colorado Rural Schools Alliance. And as Dr. Colesman mentioned, we did submit written comments last week, and I think that letter speaks for itself, but I just wanted to highlight a few of the points that were made in that letter. Of course, since it supports our position, I would certainly agree with the assertion that some of these rules exceed the scope of the State Board's rulemaking authority under the READ Act, this bill, and also just your general rulemaking authority. I also wanted to point out that one of the reasons why we chose not to object to proposed Rule 3.05B about the parent appeal is, like Ms. Goff, we also struggled to think of instances where the school would deny a parent's request to have his or her child tested in English. So while we think it's outside the scope of the board's authority, we specifically declined not to object to that rule and to focus our attention on Rule 13.02, which includes the additional reporting requirements. As we state in our letter, and as the State Board is well aware, there's been an increasing number of unfunded mandates and excessive reporting requirements imposed on school districts in the past several years. And this has been particularly troublesome and challenging for rural school districts. Unfortunately, proposed Rule 13.02 is an example of both. It's an unfunded mandate and it's excessive and unnecessary reporting requirements. I'm struggling as I listened intently to the discussion as to how this isn't already required. Schools are required to report the assessment that's administered to each student. So to the extent that the State Board is unwilling to eliminate Rule 13.02, we would encourage the State Board to consider imposing this burden on CDE instead, because the schools are reporting all this information and they would be in a better position to analyze the data and report to the State Board to the extent they find that necessary. Thank you for your consideration of our letter and for my testimony.
Thank you very much. Dr. Coltman, could you respond to her suggestion that you all do all this work since the data is already, apparently the data is already being reported, and if there were a way to pull it out?
Madam Chair, I think, could you phrase the, maybe
help me
for understanding purposes, do you in fact currently have the data reported by the districts in some format to answer the two questions that appear in 1302 B and C?
So what the department collects on an annual basis is the interim assessment score and the name of the assessment that the student has been assessed with.
This is under the READ Act, right?
Yes.
We're in the READ Act.
Okay. We're in the READ Act. So, Mr. Durham, are you asking, can you tell me which two pieces, A and B?
Well, you would
actually,
have,
can you see?
In other words, you would know if student X, as a first grader, was deemed to be not English proficient, which is the only excuse, I think, in the law for failure to test in English, partially proficient, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And you could then identify that same student in grade two who was again not rated as partially proficient and who was then not rated as partially proficient. So you would be able to report, if this board requested, you would be able to include in the report to the legislature that picking a district at random, say Denver Public Schools had 3,000 students that failed to become partially proficient after a full year of instruction. Would you be able to do that, even though recognizing it's some work to do it?
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do my best to answer that. What we could do is pull from the access assessment the student's access score. We wouldn't know at which level a district would consider the student to be partially proficient.
But if they took the same, if they failed to test in English, their excuse has to be, under the law, mm-hmm. that the student is not partially proficient, because mm-hmm. the law says if they're partially proficient, they're to be tested in English. Mm-hmm. So you can conclude, if you know you have 2 years of testing in Spanish, you know that the student did not become partially proficient in English.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Otherwise, they would have to test in English.
Mm-hmm. Once. So, Mr. Durham, I do believe that technically that you are correct, that we can use the data sources that we have to perhaps answer that question, or actually to answer that question, I think it would be pulling together some different data sets in parts that don't currently speak to one another, but I believe we can make them speak to one another.
So it's kind of difficult for us. It would be easy for the district. I completely mm-hmm. reject the idea that this is some sort of difficult mandate. I learned a long time ago, serving in the legislature, if a department or a district wants to do something, it's free. If they don't want to do whatever it is, God hasn't made that much money yet. So they don't want to do it. It's not a question of burden in this case. So as long as this can be done, then, and I think, and the board insists that this is done, and we include this in part of our report, it might discourage failure. And then how about number two here, where I wouldn't guess we would have any way to determine if a parent, let's see, if a parent's request had been denied. We wouldn't have that data. So, and I'm sure that's a tremendous burden to keep track of the number of times you deny a request, since according to the testimony, they couldn't think of a reason why anybody would deny a request, but so that this is essentially no burden at all. So I completely reject that the testimony is disingenuous.
Thank you. So to the citizen who's wanted to speak, did you want to speak to this topic or public participation? Because that's coming. That may still be out there, in fact, to sign up. Is it?
That is. That happens after this hearing.
Okay. So there's the sign-up sheet is still out there for you to sign up. Just so to make sure that we have a record of everyone who wants to speak. Are we ready for? Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Mazick.
Well, I think I mentioned this during the last discussion, last topic on the ELL. Again, I'm really curious, how many districts are we talking about that are administering the READ Act in Spanish? Mm-hmm. Because that's effectively the only second language assessment we have, right? Mm-hmm. There are no second, even though
that's
we have
correct.
A variety of languages. Mm-hmm. And remind me, what do those students take? Mm-hmm. Nothing at all if there is no alternative language, state board approved assessment?
Mm-hmm. So I will answer. I think you're asking two questions there. So currently, the majority of districts that would want to take advantage of this opportunity would be those districts that are providing a bilingual program.
Right. How many are there?
We're not talking
about every district
we're probably
talking about very few.
When we've looked at some original kind of numbers around this, it's probably around a dozen districts, and we're probably thinking this applies to around 5,000 students per grade level, I believe. So we can get those exact numbers for you. So I think it's just helpful to just have that perspective. So that's a good question. The other question you asked was in relation to other languages. So right now, the only language other than English on a state board approved assessment is Spanish.
Right.
So right now, unless the board were to adopt assessments in other languages for that K-2 reading grade level span, this would not apply to any other type of dual language program. So my Chinese example wouldn't apply here unless the board were to adopt a Chinese assessment or a dual language French program or something.
But what do those students who are native Chinese speaker, mm-hmm. native Somali speaker,
right.
native,
right.
what are they taking any READ Act assessment at all?
They are required to.
So they take it in English.
That is correct. And what we've provided in our guidance is an opportunity for a teacher to use a body of evidence to determine whether or not that student's read assessment score is really reflective of their reading skill. They couple that with their access score to get a sense of whether or not they believe that the reading score is because of their language development. So if they're an NEP or on that scale of 1 to 6, if they're maybe a 2, they might determine this is probably because the student doesn't yet have all of the language of English in order to be able to perform on the READ Act assessment.
Well, I just find this very interesting that we have, you know, we hear about that a lot. We have a variety of different languages, you know, particularly with the refugee mm-hmm. Population that we're serving. Mm-hmm. They're taking the assessment or they're being excused mm-hmm. for, and it's being explained mm-hmm. So it seems like we're carving out quite an exception for Spanish, native Spanish readers. And I'm just wondering just how important it is. You know, we could have that same explanation for the native Spanish speakers. They're not proficient in reading in English yet, but that's because their native language is Spanish, and they're not there yet. Seems like we're creating an awful lot of rules for a small subset.
So I'm not,
but a subset. Right.
One thing I think is important to note is the majority of districts who want to assess their students in Spanish are because they're offering a dual language program, especially a transitional dual language program where they start off with the majority of instruction in their native language and then slowly transition them to English over a series of years.
And that's why I'm asking. Mm-hmm. I think it's important for the board to know just how many districts we're talking about here and how many students, to put this into perspective.
Yep.
So
by the way, we were able to get that four districts are assessing in Spanish currently.
And also my next question is how many districts that have English language learners don't test their students in their native language at all and still test in English and report in English, report their results in English. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to understand.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a good question.
It's a matter of policy. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, it's a matter of law now.
Yeah, Board Member Flores.
Yeah, and just one last thing. If you look at the scores of kids who speak another language, aside from English speakers who speak another language other than Spanish, you find that those kids are at grade level. Most of them are at grade level, whereas Spanish kids are just behind and behind and behind, and the gap gets greater because they're not taught in English. They don't get the number of hours that they need in English. And when many of these districts are trying out curricula, which is, you know, in another language, in Spanish. So we're kind of experimenting in a way with Spanish speakers, and it's not fair. If their parents want their kids, Spanish speakers, to learn English and to be in an English classroom, they should be able to have that ability to do so. It's just, to me, it's just, and when I get all these questions, why can't I just get my child in an English classroom out there when I'm, you know, just out in a meeting or out at a restaurant or whatever, it really kind of goes back to why can't these kids go to the class that their parents, and in a language that the parents want them to. It's usually English. I hardly hear anybody that, you know, I want my child in a Japanese class or that's.
So I believe that concludes our rulemaking hearing. If there's no further discussion, I would entertain a motion. Yes, you may ask a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding the implications of Item 13.01D, if the LEP is required to administer to a student at least one assessment in English, either because the student has demonstrated at least partial proficiency in English or because the student's parent has requested the student be assessed in English. And it's my understanding that's actually not a requirement since the district retains the ability to deny that parent at their discretion. Then the LEP must submit the student's score on that English assessment. Does this represent a change in the interpretation of the READ Act to require an assessment in English when a student has demonstrated at least partial proficiency? Does that represent a change?
So that's a good question. And that particular piece was added because of 1160, which is that districts determine at which point when they consider a student to be partially proficient in English, that's when they're going to switch over to assessing in English. This addition to that particular submission of assessment score is to ensure then that that's the score that's submitted. Because feasibly, a district may also continue to assess, in this case, the student's ability to read in Spanish for instructional purposes. And this doesn't give an, this says you get to choose which you submit. This says if you're assessing in English, you submit in English.
So it's important for us to pass this section to, in tandem with the new legislation, because this clarifies the reporting requirement with that new clarification provided by the new legislation. Am I correct?
So I believe that without changing that particular rule, the current opportunity of choosing either or would stay in place. Choosing to submit in Spanish or English would stay. What this does is says that if you are assessing in English, you need to submit the English score.
But they retain the ability to test in the student's native tongue at their discretion.
That's correct.
And report that score. Okay. Thank you very much.
Actually, what this would do is say that if you're assessing, if you're still choosing to assess in the native language, that is that's permissible,
right.
But you're not going to submit that score. You're submitting the English score.
If and only if they chose to test the child in English.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. I think I understand. Yeah.
Go. You want to go or you want me to go? I move to approve the rules for the administration of the Colorado Reading to Ensure Academic Development, READ Act 1CCR 301-92, amended as follows. On part 3.05, paren A, close paren. I would like to strike the part that says, if the local education provider denies the parent request to administer an assessment in English, the local education provider will provide an opportunity for the parent to appeal that decision to an individual or committee designated by the local education provider, period. That part would be stricken. If the appeal is denied, include that in it. So as it will read, will administer a state board approved interim reading assessment in English to the student at the request of the student's parent, the local education provider shall explain the rationale for the decision verbally and in writing. I hope that made sense.
I need to read that.
Remember, I have to repeat this.
Huh. No, what I mean is I'd like to see that on paper.
And then, can I finish what I would like to do?
You're making a motion.
I would like to strike 13.02 in its entirety, only because that goes along with what I had just said. I could read the whole one of 305, but it's huge. And all I'm doing is striking the appeal part. But I wanted to include the part. No. The last part where it says the LEP shall explain the rationale. In other words, there's two options. The district can just say no to the parent, which I believe the parent deserves an explanation in writing. So they have to explain to the parent why they said no.
But then would they write it by placing the student in an English classroom?
Second. I'll second that motion.
Okay, now I'm supposed to repeat that motion. So a motion's been made by Board Member Rankin and seconded by Board Member McClellan to approve the rules for the administration of the Colorado Reading to Ensure Academic Development READ Act 1 CCR 301-92, amended as follows. 1, striking the sentence in 3.05A that reads from, where'd it go? Here we go. If the local education provider denies the parent request to administer an assessment in English, the local education provider will provide an opportunity for the parent to appeal that decision to an individual or committee designated by the local education provider, period. Strike that sentence. And strike proposed rule 13.02 in its entirety. Can I screw that up?
A few more words right after that period that would then be hanging out if the appeal is denied. Should also
No, I didn't. No. The beginning of that next sentence?
Yes.
So the next sentence is truncated mm-hmm. by the elimination of if the appeal is denied, and then there's a capital T, the local education provider shall explain the rationale.
We need a copy. We need a copy.
I have asked some staff to try to track this and then print it. It just might take a minute or two to make sure we get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Unless you guys are comfortable, I just heard the request.
No, I got it. I'm sorry. Okay. I got it now because I thought that there was another insert. But
okay, are we ready to call the roll, or there's still some questions on the motion?
A point of order.
Sure.
I'd like to request the division of the question and vote on each part separately, the amendment to 305A. And the amendment to 1302B separately.
So we got three motions?
No, you just have a division of the question.
I don't know what that is, so explain that to me.
In other words, we vote on the first part.
So it's like three or two?
No, you vote, you just treat them as if they were second motion, separate motions without making them as separate motions. They're divided. Motion doesn't have to be repeated.
So we start with the first one before the words amended.
305. Start with 305. All 305. The amendment to 305 is taken separately from the amendment from the striking of 1302.
Okay. Are you fine with that, Ms. Cordial? All right. Would you call the roll for the first?
For just 3.05A, striking the sentence and a couple of words both Board Member Rankin and Schroeder read. Board Member Durham?
No.
Board Member Flores?
No.
Board Member Goff?
Yes.
Board Member Masnak?
No.
Board Member McClellan?
Yes.
Board Member Rankin?
Yes.
No, this
was 3.05.
No,
it's 3.05A.
But it was your amendment.
It's your version.
Yes.
Yes.
Board Member Schroeder.
Yes.
So one piece I'd like to clarify is because it is not a unanimous vote at this point, the board will have to vote on these rules at the following meeting.
I think Court of Order, Madam Chair, until we see whether there's a unanimous vote on the rule as amended, you won't know whether or not the vote's unanimous.
Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you.
It's already not unanimous.
It's true.
No, taken as a whole, the question is...
Okay.
So that portion of the motion passes to by a 4-3 vote.
Go again.
So, moving on to striking 13.02 in its entirety.
Madam Chair, I'd like to speak to this if I might.
Sir?
Thank you. I intend to vote for this motion with the understanding that the staff will accumulate this information and we will include it in our report to the General Assembly, thereby relieving the school districts of the horrific burden of having to count to how many ever they have to count to. And I would just like to say, as I remember initially, and I think it's some of the testimony in the General Assembly, and I might be mistaken on this, but I think there were five districts who were actually creating the problem and actively supporting 1160. So there may be 12 districts who actually have the dual language programs, but if there are only two possible explanations for opposing this concept that's contained in 1302 and for supporting 1160. One is you don't value teaching kids to speak English. Or two, you don't want to admit failure in getting kids to speak English. Those are only two possible explanations. Otherwise, everybody should be proud to report their READ Act results. And I would say that to both Case and CASB, where you have 12 school districts apparently wagging the dog here of 179 school districts, perhaps they ought to reassess some of their own their own decision-making abilities. And I want to ask Ms. Colesman, before we proceed any further, did any districts individually comment on these rules, or did they leave it to their trade associations?
So, Mr. Durham, we only received the two letters from the individual from CSI and from the joint letter from the three.
So none of the organizations had the no school district had the courage to put its name on either defending failure or not desiring to teach kids to speak English. So I'm going to vote for this, since we can do it anyway and that we are now going to do it, because I think the General Assembly and the public deserve to know the answer.
Thank you.
Okay. Board member.
Vote.
Board member Durham.
Yes.
Board member Flores.
Yes.
Board member Goff.
Yes.
Board member Mazanek.
Yes.
Board member McClellan.
Yes.
Board member Rankin.
Yes.
Board member Schroeder.
Yes.
That motion passes, that portion passes 7-0.
So what have we?
So now we're on to approving.
I'll move the rules as amended.
Okay. I second.
Move the rules as amended. You got a second.
With both amendments.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what you guys voted against just a little while ago?
Yes, but
okay.
Sometimes the whole exceeds the value of the sum of the parts.
This is a wonderful learning lesson.
I think we need the motion read again. How would you like to do that this time?
Okay, I'll quickly go through it.
Well, there could be somebody in the audience who's as confused as I am.
You might want to do it quickly.
Okay.
So we didn't get the...
Slow and fast. Okay, so what we are approving is the amended version. So to approve the rules for the administration of the Colorado Reading to Ensure Academic Development READ Act 1CCR 3019 as amended, where Board Member Rankin said to strike section 3.05 A, and the part that is she would like stricken is, if the local education provider denies the parent request to administer an assessment in English, the local education provider will provide an opportunity for the parent to appeal the decision to an individual or committee designated by the local education provider, period. If the appeal is denied, period.
Yeah. That's correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
And would like to, and let's see, and strike the proposed rule 13.02 in its entirety.
Thank you. Please call the roll.
Board Member Durham.
Yes.
Board Member Flores.
Yes.
Board Member Goff.
Yes.
Board Member Mazanek.
Yes.
Board Member McClellan.
Yes.
Board Member Rankin.
Yes.
Board Member Schroeder.
Yes.
Yay.
That motion passes 7-0.
Okay, great. Thank you. So at this time, public comment. So I want to remind folks who are going to speak that board members do not engage in public comment. And we also cannot accept public comment on quasi-judicial matters, which I don't think we have. Right? I don't have any. Thank you. By the way, thank you, Dr. Colesman and company, for your patience. And all right, 3 minutes each. Dr. George Walker. There must be another sign up
there. Yeah, there's another.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Do you want me to read what you wrote on here, or do you have comments to make, sir?
Deja vu all over again, Steve.
listening to you, I was reminded in the 70s over at the State House of State Senator Hugh Fowler, chair of the Education Committee, and then regent in the 80s, and the discussions about English as a second language. And it has not changed a lot in the last 30, 35 years. And it's still an important issue. It's still an issue that is public. Part of what's going on with DACA, immigration, all those issues that we're reading about currently in Washington, a large part of it is English language as a second language or language of your original country. It's there. The language part of it is a large part of the immigration issue. I came here to speak about the five-day school week. Jenny Brandine and Ryan Waters of Colorado Public Radio have done a pretty good job of interviewing the superintendent in Sterling about an election they're having November, about whether they're going to stay on 4 day or 5 days, the implication to staff, the implication to learning. The Department of Education was kind enough to get some information to me in 2011. There's a report prepared by Diane Leffley, PhD, and John Penn, Executive Director of CDE Field Services, about this issue. And it would seem that the issue is a six-hour day or a seven-hour day, and basically the days are longer with 4 days, and the contact hours are about the same. And the test, I've called deans of several schools of education, the test results are test learning are about the same. Of course, most of the 4 days are in rural area. Half the state is on 4 days. I don't know the name. I know the name of the school. I think it's a charter school in Denver that's on 4 days. I'll find that out. I think this issue deserves revisitation since 2011, and obviously as a member of the public, I can't put something on the agenda. But you are, the CCHE and this board is coming forth with a major report in December about teachers, salaries, education, and education issues in gender. I think this report needs to be updated and revisited by the board. I personally really think, and I sound traditional, we need to stay on a five-day a week. Thanks for listening. I guess my time is up. Thank you all. And it was a heated discussion today about learning. We're lucky to have experts, including Dr. Flores, a nationally known expert on English language as second language. We're lucky to have her and all members of this distinguished board discussing this issue. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Walker. Callan Clark.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chairperson Schroeder, State Board members, and Commissioner Anthens for the opportunity today to provide testimony. I am using the public comment time to give you feedback regarding the proposed rules for the administration of the Protection of Persons from Restraint Act, as I'm unable to be here this afternoon when you're going to be looking at the rules. My name is Callan Clark. I'm the Executive Director of Student Services for Englewood Schools. And I'm here today on behalf of the Consortium of Special Education Directors, formed in 2004, to help policymakers understand issues related to children with disabilities. Our membership consists of 100% of the districts and administrative units in Colorado. This testimony also represents CASB, CASE, the Colorado BOCES Association, and the Colorado Rural Schools Alliance. The consortium appreciates the productive meeting we had with CDE and Melissa Colesman in July regarding early draft of the proposed rules. In addition, each of our organizations appreciates the opportunity to give feedback to CDE staff for consideration of our input on October 4th. Each of our organizations was actively involved in the legislation leading to these proposed rules, House Bill 17-1276. We support clarity of state rules for protection of students from restraint and for clarity of a complaint process for a student or a student's parents. We have two areas that we want to call to your attention and request revisions to currently proposed language. Our first concern relates to the required content of the complaint as specified in Section 2.07, Paragraph 2. What we believe is missing is the need to state if the child has been identified as a student with a disability under the Individuals with Disabilities Act, or IDEA. This would provide critical additional information to facilitate accessing the appropriate complaint process, as well as to support an efficient and complete response by the district or school identified in the complaint. We urge that this information be added as a component of the required contents of the complaint. Our second area of concern is in Section 2.07, subparagraph 4, which details the complaint process involving children with disabilities and what we believe is unintended and confusing language. In paragraph 2.07, subparagraph 4A, it clearly states that if, and I quote, the complaint alleges a violation of IDEA or its impending regulations, the complaint will be processed through the CDE's IDEA dispute resolution process. However, in this same paragraph, it continues with language that, and I quote, in these cases, the state complaint officer shall also have the authority to investigate and process a complaint alleging improper use of seclusion and restraints. We believe that it's important for the process to be clear, straightforward, and coordinated, and that the intent of the proposed rules is that the IDEA complaint process will be followed if the complaint alleges a violation of IDEA for a child with disabilities, including improper use of seclusion or restraints. However, we are concerned that the language in Section 2.07, subparagraph 4A, as currently written, could be interpreted as allowing for different independent, and making it very confusing. So we hope that you can look at that for us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kathy Shannon.
I apologize, Madam Chair. I'll just wait until the rulemaking
hearing.
Yeah.
Great. Alan Kennedy Schaefer.
Good afternoon. My name is Alan Kennedy Schaefer. Some of you know I'm a candidate for Senate District 34, but I'm here today as a teacher. I'm currently teaching through the CU Succeed program at Abraham Lincoln High School in Southwest Denver. We talk a lot about public policy. I'm in the PhD program that Dr. Anthe's graduated from. But sometimes we forget the real-world implications. This semester, we didn't get textbooks until week 5. A week earlier, 10 textbooks showed up for my 40 students, and the students said, "Mister, what are we supposed to do with 10 textbooks?" I think this is abysmal. I think it is failing our students. Something we need to note is that Abraham Lincoln was on a list of schools targeted for closure, and morale is exceedingly low. The teachers and the counselors work very hard, I can attest to that, but the resources just aren't there. And I'm concerned that this reflects larger inequities in our school system. We know statewide that we're underfunding our public schools, both at the K-12 level as well as in the higher education level, and I think we need to look very seriously at whether we're providing the resources to these schools that they need. That when it's a matter of do we have textbooks in our schools, I think that is fundamental to the issue of whether we are providing an adequate public education to all students in Colorado. Everyone deserves to have a high-quality education, whether they do that through public education or whether they choose to do it elsewhere. And we can't leave students behind simply because they don't have transportation or the parental involvement to go to some of the better schools in Denver. My students in my class, almost all of them, take public transportation to get to school. Half of them are late to the first period class, and yet the school district does not even provide a pass for everyone in our schools to get on RTD. I mean, that's something that the state and the district should work together on in providing, at the very least, passes so that all of the students can get to school without having to worry about how they're going to get there. So these are just a few issues that I've noticed teaching criminal justice at Abraham Lincoln High School. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Nice timing.
Good timing.
Mariana Pakova.
Good afternoon. I'm Mariana Patkova. I finally made it to be here today. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sure you know my case. As of March, I have been trying to obtain the GPA recovery approval for my daughter, Anna Karina Patkova, because the STEM school breached its contract with the DCSD district and did not implement any actions for my daughter when her GPA fell below 2.0. I have tried to talk to the school and the DCSD board, and no one is taking any action. Because of this, I'm here to say what I would want to do in order to further this case. I will make, later today or tomorrow, I'll make a complaint about the DCSD to you because they have not taken on my case. I have asked many times for the DCSD counselor to give feedback for my case and to specifically state if he sent a notice to the STEM school for breach with the opportunity to cure. I have passed through all of the steps in the school's contract except the mediation because I have been going in front of the district board on a monthly basis and no one has taken any action. Therefore, I do not know how to conduct the mediation portion. It's written in the contract, either party may appeal to the state board. So please take action in this case because no one is doing anything and you are the highest power and there has been clear misconduct to severe extent. This is not a simple case of GPA or grades. This is a severe case of misconduct. In response to past emails, you should be more frustrated with this state's education than that on my own. Because if people were doing their jobs properly, I will have no frustrations at all. As a state board, you have a duty to the children in the education system and should take action to help supervise and oversee situations where there is clear struggle. Could you please tell me how and why my daughter got two Fs, but she was almost to have five Fs in the first semester of the last school year? So please ask the DCSD members to make an amendment with a GPA recovery at school's fault for such a risky school. Thank you, and please help me to put my daughter's grades back on her transcript because it wasn't her fault. I'm here. I came from a communist country. I took classes with all classes or all levels of students, including gypsy kids. And I'm sure that the teachers over there, they were teachers for everyone in those classes. So you have to take a student and you have to say, okay, I want to go through all steps, all means in education to see, to check if this student is dumb or not. But my daughter was like having like almost five Fs. This is something weird, and I'm a teacher. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I believe that's the end of public comment. We've already done that one. Update from Commissioner Anthus. And not that you're hungry.
No. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will try to keep this quick because I'm between you and lunch. So just a few things that I've been up to. I did go on a literacy tour, which is co-sponsored with our library office, our literacy office, and then Colorado Serve. I went to Brighton Elementary, went to a library, AnyThink Library in Aurora/Thornton, and I got to read to little kiddos, and that was really fun. So. But it was a really good event to sort of accentuate the importance of literacy and families and literacy. Just a quick update on the request to reconsider process. We have had 11 districts that have submitted drafts to us. just to get the scope of what we're working on for a request to reconsider, and about 57 specific schools to submit a request to reconsider. They have until, that's the draft process, which we just offer them feedback on that so they can refine it. And so we don't know for sure what we'll get finally, but they have until October 16th to submit that. We're sort of guessing that all told between districts and schools will have around 100. So that's a dramatic decrease from what we had last year. So just to give you guys a scope of that. Letting you know, I will promise to give you updates on the Education Leadership Council as I get them, as I'm the co-chair. Board Member Schroeder is also on that council. We have our second meeting on October 23rd in Pueblo. At that meeting, we are scheduled to get a presentation of the Colorado education landscape, really done by an external partner, by CU Denver. And then we're going to be talking about more clarity on kind of what the ELC will do, by when, and with who. So,
excuse me, is this your recent new commission?
Yes, this is
the commission committee.
It's a council.
Council.
Education Leadership Council, created by executive order. Representative Rankin and I co-chair that, not to be confused with Board Member Rankin. Representative Rankin and I co-chair that.
But I was thinking of your teacher's cabinet.
Right, that's a different thing.
That's different.
That's
right.
A different thing, yes. So we will give you an update at the November meeting around how that goes and what we talk about and any materials. I will collect any materials for you all there. I did want to just let you know it's Family and School Partnership Month this month. And so I have a few brochures. We have been working to really increase parental and family engagement in schools. And so we have a bunch of materials and promising practices that we're sharing with districts. We had a kickoff. Where are my notes on the kickoff? We had a kickoff on that. We had about 75 folks in attendance, about 20 districts represented, and several community organizations. We had 33 poster displays of promising partnership practices to engage more parents and families in schools, and the event was a real success and had a real celebratory, exciting perspective. And I did think, because you all are very interested in the family and parental engagement, I just thought I would pass out some of the brochures that we've created to share some of those good practices and encourage some of those. So I know Board Member Goff is always encouraging us to get really clear communications and materials and resources out to districts, and so just wanted to share some of that. But the whole month of October is Family and School Partnership Month, and so we're doing a series of activities throughout this month. I will be keynoting the first ever Alternative Education Campus Conference, I believe Friday. and that will be, that's really a whole series of alternative education campuses wanting to come together to share their practices and support one another. And so we will be sharing a little bit of the landscape of that conference. That is hosted by the Colorado Coalition for Alternative Education Campuses and New America Schools. So I'll be at that. And then I did just want.
When did you say that was?
This Friday. Yes. And if you guys would, I don't manage the invitations, but I can send you information on it. I believe it's going to be somewhere in the Denver metro area. So I can send out some information on that. And then lastly, we haven't given a standards update, but you wanted us to hand out from Burlington the flyers that we've been providing. By October 16th, we will have all the proposed standards changes input into our online system that will be on the front page of our website. I have some flyers here for you. We can send it to you electronically as well. I think we did last week, but we'll do it again. That this is really the time to get public, parent, educator feedback on any of those proposed changes. So I have some flyers here for you, and you can pick up some more later if you want. But this, our next big push is to get the standards, the recommendations that will be coming to you, get feedback on those so we can share with you what the public feels about what the committees did. So with that, I believe I'll let you eat lunch.
Questions? I have a question.
Yeah.
For the feedback on the standards that will begin mid-month, are we reaching out to the higher ed institutions to make sure that the faculty are looking at those, because they're not necessarily represented on all the committees? And my recollection from the standards development process, there was a lot of higher ed engagement. And I'm not sure whether they're paying attention at this point to the changes, but I think it would be helpful if we heard from them.
Good recommendation. We'll make sure we do that. And I also, you reminded me that we actually, because of your recommendation to get more just parents involved in this, our team has scheduled several parent outreach efforts around this, and they're scheduling a series of feedback meetings, including up in Grand Junction, here, other places, to really, because parents can get overwhelmed by the system, and so finding ways to really help build a bridge for how they can give feedback onto the standards. So we're also doing that work.
Okay. Any other questions? Ms. Cordial, would you please announce an executive session?
An executive session has been noticed for today's state board meeting in conformance with 24-6-4023A CRS to receive legal advice on specific legal questions pursuant to 24-6-4023A Roman numeral 2 CRS and matters required to be kept confidential by federal law, rules, or state statutes pursuant to 24-6-4023A Roman numeral 3 CRS.
Thank you. Do you have a motion to convene an executive session?
Please.
All right.